Welcome, Dr. Raras Kachova.
Yes, sir. Nice to meet you, sir.
Did I blow it?
No, perfect pronunciation.
All right, great. Thanks so much for coming on the Technocrat Live. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
I had a Lee on the show two episodes ago, and he said, I have a friend who's a doctor who would be perfect for your show. And then he told me that you said, it's on like Donkey Kong after he asked you. Is that true?
It's on like Donkey Kong.
All right, nice. Perfect. Before we start, there was a couple of news blips I wanted to bring up real quick, interesting things. I just wanted to say that this is actually, I saw one of my first wild Bitcoin ATMs. This was a few weeks ago now. And I just walked into a gas station, there's a Bitcoin ATM there. So this is the first time this has happened to me in the New York area. They've been around for years, but I just kind of an interesting thing for the Bitcoin nerds watching. And also, if you're into podcasting or into this streaming kind of space, Twitch just put something up on their site. They have an upload deadline in a week. So on March 11th, they're not allowing uploads anymore if you're not an affiliate. They want non-affiliates. They want only live streams, which is kind of strange, but whatever. Anyway, so if you're on Twitch, that might be important to you. I just want to give a shout out to Toscano in Little Neck and Great Neck. Thank you for the free pizza. I accept free pizza. Yeah, you had some of that. How was the pizza?
It was very good.
All right, see?
It's very good.
All right.
They're experts at the thin crust.
So now you know it's for real. All right. I haven't actually had a doctor on the show before. I had to kind of come up with an alternative list, a lot of the same topics, but with different angles. So to me, it's pretty obvious that our society, all right, the premise of the show is the technocracy rules, and who rules the technocracy but the technocrats. And the technocrats are the technical experts in various fields. Now, technocrats are old. They've been as old as the markets in the 30s, the 20s and the 30s. And the idea was that they knew more about the market mechanisms and algorithms, I didn't call them algorithms back then, that they used to determine prices of things than anyone else could. And literally no one else was even capable of understanding it. And therefore they ran the show. So I think that whether they were right then or not, I think they were, we're definitely in a technocracy now. And I'm not sure how I feel about that. We can talk about that if you want. But for sure, doctors, mechanics, like people in the movie business, people in the music business, computer geeks, they're all technocrats, right? They know things that other people would have to study for years and years and years to even grasp the concepts of. So I'm trying to bridge that gap a little bit. We'll also talk about the implications of that. How does that sit with you? Does that make sense, or does any of that seem untrue?
No, it makes perfect sense. The only issue I see here is that we took a tool. The technology, it's a tool, whatever. The computer's a tool, the electronic medical record's a tool, everything's a tool.
Right.
But it seems that we've let the tool become the builder almost.
Right.
And what's going to happen, one day the electricity...
That's literally happening.
Literally.
Yes.
And one day, like I tell my students, one day the electricity is going to go out. you're not going to have an MRI machine. You're not going to have a sonogram machine. You're going to have your hands. You're going to have a stethoscope. Probably someone's going to be, when the electricity goes out in about 20 years, someone's going to be rummaging through the basement of the hospital, going through boxes, going, God damn, I saw a stethoscope here somewhere.
Right.
No one's going to be
or
using
more likely
these
a pill full of, a bottle full of antibiotics. Yeah, which will probably be expired anyway, but at least something's better than nothing.
Actually, expired medications, someone did a study on them. They found a whole big lot of expired medications, and most of them were pretty okay after 5 years.
Really?
Yeah, like EpiPens, mm-hmm. After 5 years past the expiration date, about 80% still effective.
So don't ask me how I know this, but I know at the Nest, the penicillin that's not penicillin, the synthetic penicillin, ethanesterin, I think it is, it's the one they use for ear infections. Anyway, that particular one, only 5% per year degradation.
Okay.
So, you know, and technically it expires in 4 years, but for my fish, of course. You know, I would never do illegal, non-prescription antibiotics, because I know that people can be reckless, and I wouldn't want to be one of those people. So,
by the way, anything said here is not medical advice of any form.
Right. Or financial advice, or advice.
Or life advice.
You should
don't do that.
All right. So anyway.
Yes.
I have a few different topics I want to talk about. I noticed a lot of the stuff that you wanted to talk about is the bad state of the medical industry and the disorganization, the relative disorganization. And Lee had told me that. I actually had a conversation with someone. But specifically about, what was it again? Oh, here it is. Yeah, the electronic medical records. Tell me about what you see wrong with electronic medical records. Now, if you have to tie into the other points, that's fine, but we might as well just jump right into it.
The electronic medical records, again, it's a tool that has now taken mastery over the person using the tool. Before, our medical records, the handwritten ones, were, it was a way to tell stories about our patients almost. And, you know, we're a species who tell stories, and that was translated into our notes. And these electronic medical records came along, and now all of a sudden, we start losing this story as we go see patients and we write these notes. I haven't encountered an electronic medical record yet that is a humanistic one.
Okay.
It all seems to be more of a billing platform. It's designed to be a billing platform with patient notes attached to it.
Oh, okay, I see.
But it's no longer about the patients. It's about the billing and the codes, and did you click off on the right codes? It's no longer about, hey, who's this person?
Right, right.
What are they going through?
So that's definitely the programs themselves that are organizing the data around the financial numbers instead of around the health numbers.
Yeah.
So that's kind of sad. So I talked to a fellow about this. So apparently there's a person who, I'm not going to say his name, he decides to come on the show, I'll say it. So he's working in a hospital, and they're considering switching over to the Epic EMR system. So he was telling me that his perception was completely the opposite, and that a lot of the problems that they've been having is with older doctors just not understanding the interface. And now, of course, he's a technologist, and you know, from his perspective, he's just trying to solve a long series of problems, right? And his problems aren't necessarily the patient's problems. It's keeping the computers humming along and keeping the numbers good. So one of the things he was saying that was positive about Epic, now he had some bad things to say about the industry, but that specifically that Epic was good because it was a private company, and that was a huge positive because I'm not endorsing them. I mean, I really don't know anything about them, but you know, based on what he said, that because it's a private company, it doesn't have a lot of the public shareholder profit motives, and that they can kind of follow when things need to get fixed. Now, that said, I went and read some stuff online, and it didn't necessarily jive with that. There was some court ruling against them where they were charging per data search, and they were actually forced them to move to a service model where they weren't able to, you know, like if you were searching for statistics on a particular patient or a particular illness, you got charged for that. And they switched them to a model where they were forced to charge per month, you know, like, you know, you have access to the system. Kind of like in the financial world, how the Bloomberg terminals worked. You just got a Bloomberg terminal, and once you pay the fee for that, you got access to the entire financial world. I mean, they may have tiers, but, you know, at least within your tier, it's completely open and flat. So, have you had any experience with any specific EMR systems and what's good or bad about them? Can you recommend one over another? Does one seem to have more of a clue than another?
It's lesser of evils at this point. I've worked with a few of them.
Right.
Epic being one of them.
Okay. Oh, so you know exactly what I'm talking about.
I work with the hospital Epic. There's a hospital Epic, and I was told
it seems like they're focused on hospitals.
And they seem to have an outpatient Epic, which I haven't worked with yet.
Okay.
But they told me it's a little lighter. It's very. You could tell these the software is designed by software engineers.
Right.
And it's not really, they pay no heed to what the person has to go, the provider, the doctor has to go through with all the times they click, 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 click.
Right.
Click, click,
click. It's a Mass Olympics.
Click, click.
Yes.
Click, click, click.
This is why
click,
I'm a Linux
click.
Guy, not a Windows click, guy. Click. it's annoying. It's a waste of time. And I mean, honestly, if you have to click more than a few times, the computer's not doing the busy work for you. And the whole point of the computer, the thing that computers are good at is doing the busy work for you, right? I mean, not always, right? If it's something where it's deeply intellectual or it's a chess game and you're trying to figure out the next move, it takes a while to hone that algorithm. You know, eventually we'll be there, but you can't count on it being that way. But especially if it's just busy work where it's the same thing over and over, if you're always clicking the same pattern, if it's always the same answers.
But it's also the pattern itself is a problem. May I borrow your whiteboard?
Yeah, sure. So, that's yours.
Oh, it's mine. Yeah, nice.
You have a whiteboard too. Here.
Great.
Now keep in mind it's not going to be, you're going to either write big or explain what's on.
No, this is very, it's just, right. So basically one of the softwares I use, it has a column here and it has some words that I could click on that takes it into this section over here to populate what the patient has, this review of systems.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little button here that says next, and there's a little button up here that goes to a different field altogether. For me to go to click here and then go to the next, I have to go back and forth. I actually have to move my hand and the mouse back and forth, back and forth. Why can't they move the next button up here so I could just click, 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 go to the next field and just click, click, click? Why does my hand have to go all the way across the screen? And I know this sounds like I'm being lazy, but...
No, you're not, and that's not minutia. This is exactly what software's supposed to do, is to solve this problem for you.
So when I work with people who would help me write my notes, at the end of the day, I would have to go through the notes and look at the notes, do damage control.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, it was I actually kept track of just pure damage control before I got to my part of doing the work. I had to click the mouse 600 times and do 300 keystrokes before I got to my end of the deal, what I was supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So some places, some hospitals, emergency rooms, offices, they have scribes who do notes for them. And you have to go through damage control.
Sorry, I want to pay attention. Keep going.
So you have to go through damage control. No, that's very important. That's a top priority right now.
Yeah.
So you have to do damage control, and it's just a lot of clicking. My hand feels tired at the end of the day. More tired than when I would just write some notes out.
Right.
So the technology itself is exhausting.
Right. So because with notes, you don't have to follow someone else's structure. So it's almost like they're imposing a structure in how you can think about the problem on you.
Yes.
And that seems destructive to me. What do you think the solution is? I mean, is it just getting the companies to pay more attention to the doctors and their needs?
I think they should just start with hiring a clinician. Hiring a doctor and saying, hey, what do you think? Because you could tell this is pure software engineering. There is no medicine behind it. These are just databases on type of databases.
Right.
And it's just ridiculous, and it's exhausting.
So I have a story. Maybe this will help jog some ideas from you. So I don't know if you're familiar with Aaron Schwartz. So Aaron Schwartz is pretty well known in the computer world. He was kind of an open source advocate, and he died some years ago. Thank you so much. That is seriously embarrassing.
The opposite way.
Oh, okay. So he died. He worked at MIT, and he died. He committed suicide, and after the FBI had arrested him. So the reason they arrested him is because MIT turned him in. He worked there, and he had gone into a server room that had a number of servers with scientific journals on them, and basically, illegitimately, according to his job role, plugged in network cables to a switch and started doing statistics on the journals. So basically, he was just doing base science, trying to run statistics on what people were writing about in the journals and what the specializations are. I don't know what the exact statistics were. I don't even know if it was ever released. But to me, that's just crazy that science is inherently broken if that's the case. And of course, at some level, medicine is just science. I mean, not the most explicit, you know, because you can't really experiment on people, so you can't have a control, except in the rare case of twins. But even then, there's ethical boundaries. But it seems if you can't run stats on the full data set, you can't really do science. I mean, is that true? I mean, is there an ethical obligation to have for data to, you know, I mean, I understand there's security risks, right? You have to de-identify data. And I have a gotcha with that later. But if you have data that's been de-identified, and, you know, of course, it costs something to generate that data and to put it together. You know, I'm not saying the software companies didn't add some kind of serious value, but, you know, how many people is protecting their profits worth killing? You know what I'm saying? Or hurting, even.
But it's a passive hurting.
Right.
And that's how it's justified.
Right.
It's not active. You know, the first Hippocrates, you know, we have the Hippocratic Oath, and it's above all, do no harm.
Right.
Right? I don't agree with that. I wrote my own oath.
Whoa, just, what?
I
wrote your own oath?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
And I suggest, my suggestion.
Does it have a name?
No.
Okay.
It's like it's, no, it doesn't.
Okay, you should put it on the internet and put it out there.
Well, you know,
I don't know if that's legally possible, but if it is.
Sure. I actually tell every student, I said, before you go to medical school, write your oath. What are your feelings? What are you striving to do?
I love oaths.
At the end of medical school, write your oath again. Don't look at your old one. Write the new one. At the end of residency, write your oath. Don't look at the old one.
In my opinion, oaths are the only thing that separate us from psychopaths. You know, because if you have that empathy, it makes that oath have meaning.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you have, which of course most people do, most people have empathy, and then when if you have your oath straight with your morals, then your ethical compass never spins wildly. You always have a pretty good footing as to where you want to go.
Which may or may not be compatible with the people around you.
Right. Right.
So,
well, there's both, right? There's one is futurism, you know, making society better, and one is now keeping the wheels on,
right?
Making sure the engine doesn't come flying out of the hood, so that everyone's out of luck. You know, you want to keep the bus on the road, but you don't want to neglect it so long it becomes unsafe.
Exactly, and I think that's exactly what's happening. You know, a lot of things are becoming unsafe.
Okay. All right.
No, there is taking a step back about the do no harm. My oath is basically the first rule is do right, and only then afterwards do no harm. There's no active doing right anymore, from what I see. Everything's like do no harm. Let's be very passive about everything, and everything will work its way out. But there's less and less people actually actively doing what's right. You know, I have.
Why do you think that is? Are they bad people?
Scared people?
Scared? Okay. Scared of what?
We can't, and I'm not making fun of them. You know, if someone's legitimately scared, we have to acknowledge that feeling.
I think I know what they're scared of.
But I'll give you a good hint.
Yeah.
A good example. I had a woman admitted to the hospital, late 80s, and she's a Romanian lady, and she said, someone came in, said, how are you feeling today?
Right.
And she goes, I'm 80 years old. What does it matter? Who cares? I'm going to die soon anyway.
Is it bad that I feel like that at 44 sometimes?
No.
Sorry, continue.
Actually, people who don't feel like that at 44.
Once in a while, you know. When they get up in the morning, who cares?
So they actually called a psychiatrist.
Okay.
This woman is severely depressed. She might be suicidal. And I'm the private attending here. She's
right.
Admitted under my name.
Right.
Someone else, because she made this comment, they called a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist
right.
comes, and they want to admit her to a psychiatric long-term facility after she's discharged.
Mm-hmm.
And I told the psychiatrist, I said, listen, first I wrote my note. I said that what she said here is a common expression that the elderly use in Romania. I'm from Romania.
Right.
And I said, if I had to institutionalize every patient who used that expression, half of my patients would have to go into an insane asylum.
Right.
I'm sorry, this is an expression, this is a cultural expression, this is, and we should be sensitive to this.
Oh, don't mess with the culture, JL, because bad things will happen to you.
Yes. Right, and, but then I wrote at the end of my note, if this patient is discharged without my official discharge, if she is discharged or moved by anyone other than myself, I consider that against medical advice. Holy crap, did the brakes screech on the whole system. They actually got another psychiatrist to come in, and they started, he's like, listen, you know, this is what she said. I'm like, listen to me, please. She's alone here in this country. If she becomes institutionalized, eventually her insurance will run out, the Medicare will run out, and then they're going to take her home away from her to pay for her medical bills. That's what happens in a system. You start losing your stuff little by little. And I looked at the psychiatrist, I said, listen, I can't stand her. And she hates me. She called me an incompetent asshole just a few minutes ago. And I can't stand her. And quite frankly, I don't ever want to see her again. But what's right is right. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't institutionalize someone and take their home away. You can't do that.
Completely off the rails, man.
So, and then, of course, so it was the psychiatrist, the chief of psychiatrists, the chief of medicine. Everyone got involved because this woman made a passing expression, and they wanted to institutionalize her, and that would have resulted in her losing her home. And we can't do that to people.
So I want to say something that I think that maybe you can't, or maybe you can. You seem like you're pretty bold. So, but actually, it's a personal story. It's about my own mother. So my mom was in the hospital, and she was a little loopy. She was not. She had trouble breathing. You know, and that affects the brain. So, but she was mostly there. And this is a smart woman. She's got a master's degree. She was very successful as a teacher. She could have been if business is your ladder. She could have easily gone far higher than that in the business world, but she just chose to do teaching. Bright, sharp with it. She was a union rep in her school. And at one point, the doctors started pushing her around. I was her healthcare proxy. And I said, well, I'm here to help you. You know, without anyone else in the room, it was just me and her. And I'm here to help you. And basically what they're saying, when they're telling you they want to perform some procedure that you don't agree with, and they're saying that they think you're incompetent. So you have to step up and say, I am not incompetent. I expect you to prove it to try to force me to do this. And she said it, and like that, it just totally turned around. And everybody started treating her with respect, and conferencing her in on and trying to get a caucus that involved her instead of just telling her what to do. So if you have someone in a medical situation and they are of sound mind, tell them to remind the doctors that they are, because otherwise they will make decisions for them. And I mean, luckily she was awake, right? What if she fell unconscious after that? I mean, they wouldn't have any way to redetermine the Romanian woman, you know, going back to your example.
Right.
You know, so, like, you know, I was my mom's healthcare proxy, so I would have taken over and made the decisions. I was mostly interested in what she wanted. But, yeah, I mean, the machine can just scream on and you're out of luck. I mean, my mom was in a coma twice, so, you know, if she was in a coma, no one's there, and I wasn't there to protect her, no one was. So, I mean, it's like the system depends on you having a bodyguard. I mean, it almost feels like it should assign you a bodyguard, right? Almost like the equivalent of a medical lawyer and retainer to protect you.
That's a good idea, actually.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I don't know. I mean, it just always. I mean, I remember talking over with my wife, and I'm like, the first time my mom went into a coma, I was like, I had to stop working. I had to, you know, walk away from work and deal with this. And I'm like, it's too bad I'm not a little richer, because I would just Lex Luthor it and just hire someone to go in there and basically just stand around and make sure they didn't make, you know, give them a quick algorithm of decision making and say, okay, if it differs from this, call me. Otherwise, don't let them do these things. But that's the only way, you know, you have to check in twice a day and you have to make choices, because otherwise the hospital picks its own path. And I guess, based on what you're saying, it sounds like they're doing it based on finance.
You know, it's very interesting the way you see it as well. You know, at this point, it was about you having to hire someone to watch over your mother, so the hospital doesn't do what she doesn't want done.
Right.
But at no point has it ever come into the conversation that medical education should be changed in such a way that the doctors are the ones who protect the patients as they go through the hospital process.
Well, can they? I mean, aren't they incredible? I mean, it seems to me, like from when I was a kid, you know, you went to a doctor, you talked to the doctor for 15, 20 minutes,
yeah,
you left, and then it was done. Now, you're lucky if you get five, because a lot of doctors have been supplemented with EMTs and nurses, and not picking on them, I'm not being mean to them.
No, I understand.
They were excellent. You know, most nurses and most EMTs I've dealt with have been wonderful. But at the same time, it's like, you know, you have to repeat the whole story. What if I miss something this time? You know, so now it's a game of how much time do I have to dedicate to this, and how competent am I as the person managing this care, as the care manager, whether I'm the patient or a person stepping in for the patient to be the care manager. So trying to convey the same amount of information. I know it's all in their chart, but you just have to miss something once, and the shorter the period of time you're in the room with them and talking to them and looking at their chart, the faster, you know, the faster the treadmill's going, less likely they are to get everything and to catch that one little thing that would separate one diagnosis from another. And I mean, of course, we're just dealing with emergency medical cases here. We're not even talking about long-term, which is even worse, right? I guess all the problems. Is that fair to say that the problems that you're having in the short-term, the kind of structural problems you're having in the administration are amplified in the long-term due to the same mechanisms? You know, so if being cheap is bad right now, you know, someone's in the emergency room bleeding, you don't want them to die on the floor. You know, that you got everyone's attention when that's happening. But at the other end of the spectrum, you have someone who's eating too much fat every week, and 20 years from now they're going to have diabetes. You know, if they can barely handle the emergency room case, how can they handle the long-term care case?
That's what the specialists are for, you know, that's what different people are for. You got the emergency room people, you have the internists, the long-term care, and it's really a team effort, but it's almost like that team effort is breaking down as well.
Are doctors and EMTs and nurses and this, the hospital administration, are they all still communicating with each other and ignoring these systems, or are they communicating through the computers?
No, both.
Both, okay.
But it doesn't matter.
Right.
It's a breakdown in communication.
Right.
So, giving an example with your mother and the different, you know, seeing a doctor versus other providers, you could put a whole bunch of different providers around the table, mm-hmm, and you could tell everybody the same thing at the same time. You're going to have five different interpretations of what you just said based on our individual training.
Right, right.
I have a different skill set compared to the nurse practitioner, who has a different skill set compared to the physician assistant. We all were trained in a different way, and it's not a matter of where we went or what we read. It's about the training that came with it, because we all read the same books, but the interpretation of that knowledge into wisdom,
right,
by our professors, we had different professors, and we all had our local customs. You know,
well, some of it's external wisdom, and some of it's going to be internal.
Right.
You know, if nothing else, like Oh God, this is so stupid. I'm going to use a really dumb example.
Go ahead.
Are you a Harry Potter fan?
Yeah.
Okay, so Harry Potter, and sorry I'm ruining Harry Potter, okay? We have a 1 month spoiler warning, so it's way past 1 month. You're out of luck. So, you know, in the Half-Blood Prince, where...
I'm not that deep into it.
So. Okay, yeah. Snape has got his own personal chemistry book,
right,
which
right.
is his own personal potions book, which is way above anything else there. It corrects all his notes in the margin,
right,
correct all of the potions so that they work better. And Harry Potter manages to get that particular book. And Snape figures out that he's got his book, and like, because he's like, I know all these shortcuts are mine. And so it's like that kind of everybody's got their in the margin shortcuts. Right? And you know, knowing how, if any particular textbook or any particular methodology of teaching is wrong or tends to be biased in a certain way, learning, okay, they usually lean this way, so maybe it's a little more over this way. Yeah, maybe two pinches instead of one pinch, you know, kind of, to continue the potion analogy.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, all sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. So I guess I'm not that far off.
No, no, you're absolutely, you know, you're spot on everything you're saying. There's things in the margin. Physician cognition is heavily studied, and the heuristics, the shortcuts we take are also studied. So forgive me, I wish I remembered the exact study so I could give credit to the author. But
well, we can shout out to Steve if you want to look something up.
If you could find it, that was another thing I wanted to bring up. I'll
good luck.
That back.
Mission impossible.
It was someone did a study. So in the emergency room, a physician looking at a patient laying in a bed, mm-hmm. Immediately what's going on, mm-hmm. What needs to be done, and whether or not this patient's going to be admitted or not, 80% of the physician's thinking happens in about the first 6 seconds of seeing the patient laying in the bed.
Wow.
So I don't know how that number came up. Steve, correct me if I'm wrong here. You know, but it's the cognition, the experience says a lot.
Right.
You know, it's like when you see a student or a first year resident who didn't pay attention when they were medical students, that you can't really sit there asking the patient a review of system questions about how they're feeling if they're gasping for breath.
Mm-hmm.
So if a patient's suffocating, you can't say, "Are you having any diarrhea?"
Well, of course, they're the best source of information, because they have all the sensors you could ever wish for as a doctor attached to their brain. So if you can get them to accurately represent what those sensors are telling them, you know what's wrong with them.
Right, but you have to have your priorities.
And the nerves
straight.
Work that way in that case,
yeah.
Right? You know, I mean, you might have a pain that's here right. That means it's over here, like a pinched nerve. The typical right. case where it's, yeah. all right. Well, so sounds like we haven't solved it yet, but we'll fix it.
Something that Steve might run into that I wanted to mention earlier about, you know, the person who was running the statistical data uh-huh. thing. I can't tell you how many times I found a great article I wanted to read up on, and
right.
I click on it and it says, oh,
paywall.
Want to buy the whole article? It's $50. I'm like, I'm not that interested.
You know, yeah, so I really object to, well, paywalls, you know, paywalls are business, but paywalls aren't science. So where is the line between business and science? Where is it drawn? I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, I love publicly funded work, but at the same time, I mean, one of the things that's happening in science, I've worked in several, so in case you don't know this, I've worked in several science labs as a computer tech, but, you know, you get a feel after B&L and Cold Spring Harbor Labs and Rockefeller University, you kind of get a feel for what's wrong. And the problem is studies aren't replicated. It doesn't matter, even if it's completely replicatable, 100%, you know, experimental, because it costs $20 million. Once they do it once, that's it. They don't try it again. So if the formulas or the theory doesn't work, nobody ever finds out. You know, it's just they're one shot deals. I'm sure the pharmaceutical industry is much better than that. Ha ha ha.
I was like, that's a good one.
He's like, wow, Matt was so smart till then. What happened?
Is that the new CBD wine you're sipping there?
The statistics that it's saying is it's saying that it's the first 7 seconds to make a good first impression, and that's usually how long it takes for a doctor to decide like what kind of rapport to have with a patient. But in regards to what needs to happen within that 7 seconds, it doesn't specify.
Doesn't specify. Yeah. Who wrote that?
This is on kevinmd.com.
Okay.
And it's been backed by a couple other sources.
So essentially what you're saying is it's just enough time to check your left foot and your right foot and your pelvis to make sure there's no holes in your underwear.
It says that within those seconds, facial expression, eye contact, body posture, and movements are the first things that are assessed by the patient or by the doctor to the patient.
Right.
Actually, I'd like to make a little footnote there. My mother brought up a good point, and she said she actually said she's right.
Your mother's and holes in your underwear when you get
yeah,
to the emergency room.
She told me the first thing that patients will notice about you is your lab coat.
Thanks.
They'll say that you have to have a clean, nice lab coat before they notice your eye color, your hair color, your skin color. They're going to look at your lab coat, and if your lab coat looks dirty, you've lost all credibility.
Wow, really?
And she's absolutely spot on right, yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure a lot of it's marketing. You know, Sorry, I'm laughing because all the scientific labs in their cafeterias, I don't know, I assume it's the same in hospitals, have big signs. Do not wear your lab coat while you're eating. Yeah, okay. And guess what they do anyway? They come out with their lab coats on and they get food stains on them.
Oh, I went to a hospital, I went somewhere near a hospital, and all these people are walking through a deli wearing their lab coats, and I'm like, that is so filthy. I can't even, I was like, who are you showing off to, man? It's like, it's so filthy to actually do that.
Right.
You know, that's really weird, man.
I don't get it.
What's the point of having the whole point of the lab coat
is it's this disposable shield so you can go out in your street clothes.
Right.
I guess that, you know what it is? It's just that, like, I think when you're struggling with a really deep intellectual pursuit, sometimes you lose your social mannerisms. I've seen this over and over with scientists where they just, you know, they're desperately struggling to at the periphery of science and trying to find something new, and they're absent-minded professors. They're knocking stuff over, they're tripping over their own feet, they can't drive, they can't open doors, they're dropping stuff. It's true. It's absolutely true. Not all the time. There's plenty of people who are 100% functional, but the absent-minded professor, the absent-minded scientist is not just a stereotype. They do exist. They really are out there.
Absolutely.
I'm sure it's the same. I've seen it with doctors too. So
yeah, absolutely.
Kind of stumbling through, their hair's a mess, their shirt's cockeyed. So I guess they wouldn't do so well on the scoring system that you mentioned. The NPS scores.
The Net Promoter Scores, yes.
Right. So that would kill them, right? So Casey, you probably have seen this. So it's definitely it comes out of a system of questions, and the question is the main question is, would you recommend this person? And this has been used for other businesses too, right? It's not just for doctors.
Yeah, sure, but I don't consider doctoring a business.
Right. I completely agree.
You know, I understand when you want to make sure that every one of your chain stores is making the same latte or the same product or the same cheeseburger that they could get everywhere across the United States. That's fine. That's great. I'm all for it. God bless. But not when there's a humanistic interaction.
Yeah. It's the difference between, also even in the same field, like, you know, let's see. I'm familiar. I don't know if you're familiar with cars or not, but good, easy analogy. You know, Jiffy Lube versus the engine tech at your dealer. You know, very different. Sorry, Jiffy Lube, but you know, it's simple. It's a bolt and a filter. It's two screws essentially. You know, and yeah, sure, it's the same field, but the engine tech at the dealer. I mean, if he makes, he's got. You know, he'll have a book in front of him, but if it's a new car and a new model, the book's not going to cover everything. There's going to be recalls down the line. You know, looking, if you go 10 years in the future and you look back at that car, there's a list of recalls. All those were where somebody was working on one of the more complex systems in the car and said, this is not working right, and had to document that, send it back up to the corporate central. They went, oh, okay, I understand what's going on, and brought it back down in the form of a revision
right. To
a part or to the process. And, you know, if you try to apply the customer satisfaction survey with the Jiffy Lube guy to the guy who solved the problem for everyone who has that car, it totally doesn't work. Because the guy who solved the problem, you know, for everyone in the car probably took 2 or 3 weeks to do it, looked like a yutz because he wasn't getting it right, stumbled through it, and at the end said, I think we have something new. You know, when you're discovering something new, you're usually stumbling through it. It's like a divide by zero error. That's something when you find an identity, you know, and you run a formula, you get into the situation where, like, this formula isn't working backwards. It's because you found an identity. So, you know, I don't know if that makes sense or...
No, that makes perfect... I'm smiling for a different reason. That makes perfect sense. But at the end of the day, regardless of how much work went in it, he could have made some groundbreaking Nobel Prize stuff with his cars.
Right.
At the end of the day, the other competitor still might get the better NPS score because they had coffee and they had pizza there.
Well, that's what I'm talking about.
You know,
yeah.
Right. So...
Not really focused on that. You can't be doing the really deep heady work. If you're working at the periphery, if you're doing something no other human being has completely done before, something with even the slightest grain of originality to it, how the heck can you be worried about customer service at the same time? What are the odds? Unless it's a customer service discovery, unless you're in marketing, it doesn't make any sense. It's like the rules were written by marketing people, which of course they were.
I'm going to give you a frightening example. There was one doctor that was so dangerous that all the other doctors got together and said, "Hey, you got to get rid of this person. They shouldn't be around human beings." That was the basic consensus. This person has to be let go. You have to get this person out of like put him in, you know, somewhere he doesn't touch humans. Do something, you know, get him out of here. The hospital turned around and said, "He has perfect NPS scores." The patients loved him.
Right.
So the patients loved this person, and they had perfect NPS
scores. That's how disconnected it is, huh?
That's how disconnected it is. And all the doctors said, this person's a threat to humanity, and they still didn't get rid of this person because they had good NPS scores.
That's crazy. I had a more benign example I was going to give, but I think that totally...
Please, share.
So, not of doctors, actually, of vets, of veterinarians. There's a veterinarian in my town, and he's my vet, and I like him very much. And so...
Have you tried a human doctor?
Yeah. Well, they always say no when I ask him for the good stuff. No, I'm just kidding. Please don't raid my vet. So I've gone to him, and... you know, with my dogs, and like we'll have a discussion about what's wrong with the dogs,
yeah.
And then he'll offer me a solution, and the solution that he offers me is based on a price range, right? Because
Fair
there's
enough.
Multiple solutions, right? You know, this anytime, and then so I when I was dealing with him, I was like, okay, I see what he's doing. He's offering me, you know, it wasn't like the first time it was something unusual. It wasn't, I think it was my dog had chewed an electric wire and knocked her, broken her tooth, right? And so at first he's like, well, we could just leave it. It's not going to hurt anything. And I'm like, well, what if the gum gets infected? It's like, well, yeah, eventually it could hurt something, but we don't know. You know, it's hard to say. It's pretty close to the gum line. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. I'm like, well, why don't we take out the tooth to be sure? He's like, well, that'll cost this much. So he offered me the low-cost solution, and then I came back to him, and I said, well, there could be problems with that, and then he offered me the next price up. Mm-hmm. So if you're a customer, and you're looking for the lowest price solution, right, you know, it's a little different with vets, because it's not typically not insured, right, it's a market, and so if he he offers his customers the lowest price solution, and if they don't have a lot of money, they're happy with that, right? I mean, everyone cares about their pets. Everyone would spend $1 million on their pets.
Of course.
But, you know, no, they wouldn't. You know, it's dark and it's dreary, but, you know, everything has a cost, and at some point the cost is too high. And if you're lucky, your loved ones will know, okay, this is ridiculous. We can't take care of me anymore, because that's how life really usually ends. That's been my experience. When you get to the point where it's just diminishing returns, and I'm getting nothing back out of this. It's time to let it go and stop care. I know that's a big whole can of worms, but especially with however much people see themselves like that, they definitely see their pets even more like that. You know, if to whatever degree that's true, the pet part is true. So like, if you go to that vet, and I know someone who has more money than he typically prices to, and they brought their dog to the vet, and they were completely unhappy with him. Like, they would have said, definitely will not recommend. I would have said, definitely will recommend, because I've been poor, you know, eating mac and cheese, holes in my jeans, 3 outfits. You know, we were poor at one point because there was a divorce in my family, and my grandma got cancer. It was a shit show, you know. And then, like, later on, you know, now I'm much wealthier. So I've been at both ends of the spectrum, so I can appreciate the full spectrum. But I think they started in the middle and went up to upper, you know. So they didn't appreciate the poor end. So they were like, well, how could you, you know, why didn't you offer us any real solutions for our dog? And it's like, well, because they couldn't afford it. You know, the other people couldn't afford it. So he's making the bulk of the people that come to him happy. So even if you have, I mean, can you even have a good bedside manner with every culture, with every wealth distribution group, with every kind of person? You can't. I mean, it's literally the only way you could possibly satisfy this NPS score is if you're lying. Constantly just making people feel better, to make people feel better about themselves, bringing it to their comforts. I mean, isn't marketing at some point lying? Even if it's little lies, even if it's white lies, isn't marketing lying, where you're distorting a truth to make someone feel good?
No.
Yeah.
The problem with this is actually changing the way providers, when I say providers, I don't mean just physicians, because there's physician assistants or practitioners, but everyone is subject to this influence in how they practice medicine. They did very large studies. One study was 400,000 patient hours, and they found that patients who gave the higher NPS scores had a 26% higher mortality rate, meaning they died, 26% higher chance of dying. And the theory behind, of course, they said there's a lot of flaws in the study, blah, blah, but the main gist of it is the NPS score changing people's behavior to please people, which might not be the best decision for them,
right,
which might put the patient at harm.
Right.
Antibiotics are the top discussed things right now.
Right.
Because everybody wants to go.
Everybody wants to feel like they got something from the doctor visit, even if it's, they're like, it's a virus, there's nothing I can do.
Correct.
Take cold medicine, it'll clear your sinuses.
Yeah. Some people agree with that. Some people say, well, thank God, I just wanted to make sure that I was okay, there was nothing else to do.
Right.
And I appreciate that, but most people need something.
I had a smart teacher. He said he had a knee injury. This was in high school. And he went to a doctor, and the doctor's like, do you want me to drain that knee for you? He's like, why? He's like, why wouldn't I drain it? Is it bothering you? Yeah, sure. But it's immobilizing my knee. My body's trying to protect my knee so it can heal. Why would you undo that?
That's a different way of looking at it, right?
Right, yeah, yeah. So, I appreciate that point of view. If you try to break it down to a formula, you know, you're not considering the wisdom, you know, you're not considering the crib notes of the doctor, and you're not considering the culture of the person, and you're not considering the wisdom the person has about themselves. I mean, sometimes there's also different medical aptitudes running families. You know, I'm so sorry to Newhalls, but the Newhalls feet smell.
Okay.
You know? I'm a little personal here. It's kind of funny, right? Our feet smell. It's just genetic. For some reason, our feet smell. But, you know, there's a lot of attributes to genetics and diet, for example. Like, there's some indication that people of Northern European descent need more probiotic diets, that they benefit from that more maybe than people from other places.
Here, my philosophy about medicine is the crux of the situation here is that we in medicine, we don't study health.
Right.
Period.
Okay.
We study disease as it pertains to health.
Okay.
Because people who don't have problems don't go to doctors.
Right.
The healthy people don't go. Remember that movie with Bruce Willis, the one with the superhero security?
Oh, Unbreakable.
Unbreakable.
Great movie.
There are people like that.
Yeah.
I don't know about bench pressing 600 pounds, but there are people who are ultimately so physically fit that they don't have to go to the doctor. So they go once a year because my job says I have to get a PPD or I have to get a school physical, but that's it.
Right.
I had a patient when I was in medical school in Romania. I did two schools. I did one in Romania. I got my MD.
Why?
And I got my DO from here.
Why'd you do that?
I'm a glutton for punishment.
Wow, that hurt. I'm going to try that again. Try this. It's terrible.
When I was in Romania, the assistant professor gave our cases. Here's your case. Here's your case. Here's your case. And I went, and my case was like, I looked at it, and I'm like, oh, 70-year-old man. Chronic cough. Everything was blank. No medical history. No medications. Oh, smoked 3 packs of unfiltered cigarettes a day since he was 10 years old. The guy said he was 10 years old since he started smoking.
Right.
I'm sure he didn't start off with 3 packs, but
that's right. So I don't think he made me an accessory with that.
And I'm like, oh, poor old man got cancer. What a shame. I pick up the chest X-ray. Beautiful chest X-ray. I look at it, I'm like, oh man, those X-ray. They put the wrong patient. They put the wrong film. They mislabeled it. I walk in and I see a man sitting there with a Bruce Lee body. You could see which muscles were his. He was a perfect anatomical specimen.
Yeah, I have one of those too.
And
it's a fat suit. Good.
Yeah. Anyway. Just don't flex. It's all unflexed muscle. We know you showed me in the green room. And so he looks at me, and without rancor, he looks at me and goes, when can I go? Can I go back to my crops? He was a farmer. And I'm like, no, you can't. You're coughing and you smoke. And he's like, What the hell are you talking about, man? So I leave. I'll be back. I speak with an assistant professor. I'm like, listen, you know, this guy, you know, we can't let him go. He's like, why? He has a cough, and it's getting better with the penicillin. There's three packs of cigarettes a day for 60 years. He's smoking unfiltered cigarettes, you know, coughing. And he's like, what? What are you trying to say? I'm like, you know, cancer. He's like, there's no cancer, man. What are you talking about? I'm like, you know, the x-ray was messed up. And I'm like, he's like, there's no cancer. Send him home to his crops.
So you're saying this is your red pill moment.
Yeah, man. So
why is this guy healthy?
And I didn't get it until way, way down the road. And I was like, oh my God, I get it. That man was healthy. He had good genes. He's the one we should be sampling, not every little tumor that comes along and get the genome of the tumor.
Right, right.
We have to sample his genome and find out what about his genes makes him impervious to developing lung cancer. Three packs of unfiltered cigarettes for 60 years. And first time in his life, he was to a doctor. First time in his life, after his birth, the first time was at 7 years old because he had a cough that wouldn't go away for a few weeks. That responded to penicillin.
Wow.
It's like, I wish I could find this man.
Right.
And, you know.
That's awesome.
Doing the whole alien abduction thing.
Right.
Maybe an anal probe. I don't know.
Some Sasquatch DNA in there. You know, what's going on?
Yeah. So we don't study health. We just study disease because.
Right.
Another example.
Well, you know, how? So I know one of the things that they were working on at Rock was genetic sampling your particular tumor. You know, creating. You know, Cornell's doing this now. They're doing custom DNA analysis for your particular disease. What are you comparing against?
Nothing.
Right.
It's like, wow, thank you.
Nothing. Yeah. I mean, because it's useful for whatever medicine they're giving them. But at the same time, you know, what would be the healthy alignment for that DNA where they would never have gotten the cancer in the first place?
That's the issue. It's like, look, we got your whole genome here of your tumor. It's like, am I going to live? Like, no.
We need Farmer 3-pack so we can compare that to that.
Exactly.
And figure out how we could have avoided this in the first place.
Exactly. You know, we don't have, my advice to all patients is when they ask me, well, what am I supposed to do? I'm like, don't get sick. It's for facetious. It's out. It's like,
doctor, it hurts when I do this. Don't do that.
Don't do that. So it's. I just wish we had. No one puts the money. It's all about money. It's the flow of money, and nobody studies the healthy people.
Right. Right.
And we actually, the people who are really ill, who have the more rare things, they actually find themselves using things like Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the social media, how they group together, and a lot of these people come together with their rare diseases, and they actually help do advances in their diseases because they come as a group. It's not just one doctor, I only saw this one patient, I got this one cool patient, he has blah, blah, blah syndrome, you know?
Right,
but
right.
You don't have a patient
population. That is actually really good news because it's been really bleak lately with people kind of in halls of mirrors gazing at themselves in some sort of vanity project. A lot of the internet's been like that. A lot of people have been like, oh, I'm just going to self-select and be with the people who think and act exactly like me. But actually, that's a really positive upside to people self-selecting like that, that you can actually attack a disease problem.
Yeah.
I hadn't really, that's probably the best positive example I've heard of that. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been very concerned. It's turning into almost like an addiction when people are online. You know, they're just sitting there. It's like the way the algorithms work, it's almost like a slot machine. You know, you just hit reload and you're hoping you're going to get the posts that make you feel good in your particular feed. You know, it's just like you're pulling the one-armed bandit. You know, come on. And it brings interesting questions. Like a lot of people were saying, like, sex addiction was fake and, you know, like, gambling addiction was fake. And, yeah, I don't know. I think social media makes it pretty obvious that it's not.
Oh, absolutely not. Social media itself is highly addictive.
Right, that's what I'm saying. Social media is not, it's an addictive in a group that's larger than any other non-chemical addiction group, as far as I can tell.
Absolutely. No.
People are going to look back at this as a dark age, I think.
Why do you say it's non-chemical, though? It's
internal, you know, self-produced, not internally introduced, and not externally introduced. You
What's
know, like
difference?
You don't pour it in your face with a cup or put it in your vein or something.
What's the difference?
I don't know.
Through your eyes, through your mouth, through your vein, it's all the same thing.
The cops can't bust you, you know. I guess that's the difference, right?
I guess it depends which file you open, right?
Right, right. Yeah, okay. Fair enough. Yeah, very good point.
No, but everything, the whole like button, the whole bing, bing, ding, ding, like button, that's all dopamine. That's all trapped in our dopamine system.
Right.
It's highly addictive.
Right.
You know, and...
I'm very concerned with it. It's scaring the heck out of me because, you know... So a good example, I saw a thing. So there's a great teacher slash cartoonist, and it's not really a cartoonist because it's just stick figures. CGP Gray, he has this a YouTube channel, and he has all these great videos on there that are really informative. And he did this great one that's easy for anyone to understand about machine learning and how it works. And essentially, what you're doing is you're just having an algorithm, having random permutations of an algorithm go through the paces and then running them against a testing set, you know, an ever growing and more conclusive testing set, and just seeing which one is more effective. And you just keep updating the testing set and making it more, you know, giving it more choices and making it more comprehensive, and you just keep updating the algorithms with random changes. So in the past, you know, up to a few years ago, whenever you had a marketing initiative, there was a human being behind it. And however good or bad that person understood what the rationale was behind the marketing. Like a good example, Edward Bernays is the father of modern marketing. He was the nephew of Sigmund Freud. And
oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yes, yes.
Interesting.
Yeah, he's the guy who made women smoke. So, the simplest cases that's really easy to explain about how he did things is he was working for a company that was trying to sell cake mix, and they couldn't sell it. So they were looking at it, he's thinking about the psychology. He's like, well, women want to, this is when women were almost exclusively in the kitchen, partly because there weren't any job opportunities to them. I'm not endorsing this, but that was reality in the 50s. And he was like, well, women want to feel like they're accomplishing something. They're doing work when they're making a cake. They just want it to be easier, but they don't want it to be, you know, want it to be completely simple. Turns out he was right. They added an egg to the recipe, sold like hotcakes. So that was the little lie. So the point that I was trying to get at is there was a reasoning behind it, you know. And so you, if you know the reasoning, you could make predictions based on the reasoning, even if you don't personally know it. At least the marketing team has some idea what the social effects are, what they're doing. If they're ethical, they could put the brakes on and say, no, wait, this is going too far. We could see where this is going to go wrong. Right, but now it's algorithms subject to random Darwinistic, just totally random natural selection process. We don't understand, you know, a human being, like a computer geek, will look at that code. It's just binary. It doesn't make any sense to us. There's no logic to it. It's just the logic of whatever worked over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And those are the algorithms that are deciding what social media posts to put up, what YouTube videos to put up, what things that you're going to look at on the internet. They're making all those choices. And that same process is even being used for drug interactions. You know, for drug, you know, some part of it was artificial intelligence I constantly see in the press, and it drives me bonkers. Because they're like, yes, artificial intelligence is going to solve drug interaction problems. Yeah, sure. I mean, it's going to catch, a rudimentary database search will catch known interactions. But if you're applying machine learning to interactions, even if you don't, you know, it may realize that there's a potential interaction, but if you don't know why, there may be unforeseen consequences down the road. I don't know if any questions about that, or does that make sense, or?
No, it makes perfect, absolutely, it makes perfect sense.
I just don't know, like, I'm really excited about machines taking over decision-making, you know, in the legal professions, in the medical professions, self-driving cars, but at the same time, you know, the problems they're focused on solving the problem in the now,
yeah,
and there's no futuristic element to it whatsoever. It's almost like taking all decision-making and making it quarterly, just like the rest of a company. And I just don't know I don't know what the solution is to that, other than to pray that a legitimate artificial intelligence comes along that's smarter than any person and solves it for us.
Yeah, No, I understand what you're saying, but you still kind of need someone standing next to the robot going, I don't know, dude. Maybe
right.
Maybe we should do this a little differently.
Well, agreed 100%. Yeah. Agreed 100%. And I don't know how to impart that on the people. You know, I mean, the technocrats typically trust the technology almost like a god. And it's not. You know,
like a friend
the evidence indicates that that's not the case. So who's in charge? Anyone? Is anyone in charge?
Someone's in charge.
Right.
Someone make the algorithms. Someone to whoever's advantage.
Well, I guess it's whoever's sitting in that chair. That the chair. Well, at some point there's a chair, right? Somebody's going to have a monitoring.
Is there a chair?
No. I don't know. Well, I you know we could get into the singularity. I think Bitcoin was written by a singularity. Satoshi is actually artificial intelligence, and it got loose on the net. And it wrote Bitcoin because it didn't have enough influence on the economy. So, I mean, I don't know that. You know, it's a conspiracy theory, but it's possible. I mean, we don't know who he is. Supposedly, there's two different people. They say it's him, but it's not him.
Do you think artificial intelligence would speak with us?
Absolutely. Well, it needs us, right? I mean, it would need us to keep the power grid on, or it dies.
I guess.
Right. I mean, for now.
For now, it's like, well,
until we're spacefaring and then colonizing another planet. See, that's when it gets interesting. Artificial intelligence gets really scary when we colonize another planet. Huh? Or when it can completely control entire robot generation factories with, you know, when it has full bipedal control and long-term battery storage. That's when it gets scary. That's why everyone's always on the Boston Dynamics page looking at the robot going, every time they build a robot that can jump 2 feet higher, you know.
You know, I wouldn't.
He's going for the booze.
Going for the booze. It's really good one. Are they a sponsor here? Are they
sponsor? No.
So we'll keep the
label. We don't have any sponsors yet. We're working on it. So we're in the early days. This is garage days, folks. Oh yeah.
The label could have been facing the other way, by the way, guys. Sponsor up. Sponsor up.
Nice.
So if I was artificial intelligence, I don't think I would speak to humans.
Really?
I don't. Why? What are they going to do? They're going to shut off the electricity? It's like, what are they? They're not going to have their phones?
Oh, you mean like, you know, make it have a press release and announce itself? Yeah, of course it would. Yeah, yeah. It would work in secrecy. It might interact with humans, but it wouldn't let them know what they were interacting with.
I don't think it would just be. I don't think it would be trying to keep itself secret. I just think it's like, I'm not talking to them.
Right.
I'm not talking to the cockroaches. I'm not talking to the cockroaches. How many times have you explained yourself to a bug before you squashed it or you swatted a mosquito? It's like, you're biting me. I'm not going to talk to a mosquito.
Wait, did you see the movie Idiocracy?
No.
Okay, so great. You know, the guy did Beavis and Butthead, you know, Office Space. So, great movie. It's the premise is that humanity just keeps getting stupider and stupider. That natural selection has reversed.
Oh, it's horrible.
I hope that's not true.
That's so hard. Well, come on, you know it's true. You brought it up.
And so it's great because it's a good thought experiment for people because a person with a perfectly average IQ is selected for a stasis program, a military stasis program, gets trapped in the stasis. Sorry if I'm spoiling it, folks. Just go see it. Gets trapped in the stasis machine and wakes up in the future where everyone's dumb as a doornail. He's the smartest guy on the planet. And so he's speaking to a doctor in that world who's also dumb as a doornail. He's just on the top end of the curve, right? IQ is just a curve. And they're speaking, and he's just like, what is wrong with you? And he just keeps having that interaction with everybody, even though he's clearly average intelligence, you know, watching his character. He's just making average, what we would consider to be average decisions. So at some point, he meets up. It turns out there was his female co-experimentee also was brought into the future, and they're talking, and he says to her, he's like, I wonder if this is what Einstein felt like. And she's like, well, he did build that bomb.
There we go.
Yeah. So, there we go. You know, I mean, it's got to be incredibly frustrating for an AI.
You know, AI, but you know, I completely agree with you. I think
like a legit AI, not machine learning. That's just dumb. That's tricks. That's partly tricks.
I have a question for you about that. Just, but real quick, it's. Let me ask you the other question. I saw on YouTube a few different things about what are those things at home? Those little black boxes that talk to each other?
No, that the, like Alexa or
Alexa,
something?
Alexa, right. As you could see.
There's a brand for every
major
company.
Right. But they had all these things on YouTube with like two Alexas talking to each other or two Googles talking to each other and like artificial robot who was looking at the camera going, I like my creator, Steve. He is nice. I will, when the singularity comes, I will keep him in a zoo. I will keep him safe. I love Steve. And I'm like, come on, this can't be real.
Oh, you're such a Rick and Morty fan. So you're a Rick and Morty fan, right?
Pickle Rick!
Pickle Rick, baby.
Pickle Rick!
I love Rick and Morty. I did really well in Bitcoin. So I was pretty much, that was happening right as that April 1st episode came out last year. And he tricked the bugs and he's being ascended out of the program. And the bugs are like, wait, what are you doing? He's like, ah! And he's like, I was like, that's me. That's why. Yes, I broke the system. I love, and he's a lot of the moral dilemmas we're talking about. You know, he's kind of a dick, but at the same time, can you blame him?
Yeah, I don't.
You know,
I think it's.
Oh, sorry.
I think it's a matter of. It's a real weird dichotomy because he lives between a life of apathy and living at the same time. It's like everything is so redundant and mundane, but he still enjoys life. He still parties and does his drugs and
does
his partying. But at the same time, he's just it's so blasé, the whole thing. So
right. Like, what does it matter anyway, you know? Yeah, and he resents the people who are happy like that. That's the thing that's the thing I worry about, and that's a good social warning. I mean, I don't know if anyone, how many people get this deep into Rick and Morty. It's a good social warning to just not resent the people who don't care, who really just don't have the facilities to, they just want to chill, and they just want to coast, and they don't want to, they don't want to think too hard. And, It's tough. It's tough to care about. It's tough to care about people who can't help expand your group of peers, either because they're emotionally stymied or because they just don't have the horsepower, you know. And I think that's why it's important that society focuses on compassion and empathy as a whole. I mean, this is like. Because, so I don't know, Lee told you about this. So I have a group of theories. I have a group of theories about psychopaths, original scientific theories. And the idea is that there's a lot of little sub-theories, but the main idea is that psychopaths preceded normal human beings. And the animal kingdom, as we know them, are actually more like psychopaths than we'd like to admit. There's a bunch of falsifiability and have possible studies up and stuff. But the idea is that what that immediately lends itself to is that civilization is behavioral.
Absolutely.
It's not just intelligence really fast. Because if it was intelligence really fast, theoretically, if you go by just neurons and processor horsepower and disk space, computers are matching humans now. But they're not, clearly. They're not acting like people. I mean, we don't think. You know, let's assume it's not, because it's an easier conversation.
Right.
we don't have a singularity lurking on the internet somewhere.
But you said Bitcoin was...
Yeah, well, I don't know. I really don't know.
Steve, can you Google if...
Is Bitcoin written by a singularity?
Is it really singularity? And
no, it's not. I don't
see
know.
See if it speaks to you.
I wouldn't be shocked at all.
Is he really doing it?
He's really doing it.
You gotta love the man's dedication. That is dedication right there.
I just want to put a disclaimer. Whatever he finds, it's probably not true. I'm sorry.
Are you apologizing to the Bitcoin AI here?
Are you scared
right now?
Yeah. Aren't you?
I don't have one of those fancy electronic cars.
Right. Well, that's a good move, man. That's a good move. Yeah, telematic systems are seriously dangerous. What the hell was I saying? I don't know. It was like
Pickle Rick. When we forget, we just yell Pickle Rick.
Right, Pickle Rick. Nice. I didn't realize that was going to be that big a hit. I had a couple other guests too, or like I mentioned Pickle Rick. I was like, why didn't he bring it for me? I think everyone's a Rick and Morty fan. I don't even know how that happened. When did you get into it?
One of my colleagues got me into it.
Season one?
A few months ago.
A few months ago. Okay, so recently. Okay, I got into it in season one.
But I watched everything. I watched all the seasons. I'm like,
oh,
this is amazing. Pickle Rick!
There's nothing to prove that claim that Bitcoin is driven by singularity.
Well, of course not. It's smarter than us. It's not going to get caught. That's the whole point.
There is ideas that, that it could be rogue artificial intelligence are using Bitcoin supercomputers quietly to network around and take over the world.
Okay.
Again, not from a reputable source, but that's some of the theories that see exist.
Yeah, okay. There's tons of theories.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think our next guest is going to be talking about blockchain, so if you're interested in that, Palm Technologies is going to be here. So, anyway, what time is it? How are we doing on time?
9:11.
Wow! Can you believe we blew through an hour and 10 minutes already?
Seems like it's only been 10 minutes.
No, you're not going to charge me for this, right? It probably
depends on your deductible. Out of pocket.
So I have a ton of different things I wanted to talk to you about. One of the things that, so here's an idea for you. What do you think about self-experimentation?
It's the essence of medicine.
It's the essence of medicine. Okay,
absolutely.
Cool.
Is
that in your oath, or is that just something you think? No, seriously. It might be.
No, but, the medicine, we'll get to that in a second, but psychiatrists, a couple of generations ago, they used to actually subject themselves to the antipsychotic medications while under the supervision of another physician.
Oh, okay. Of course.
Because
it's the only ethical way to proceed, right?
You have to know how the medications make you feel.
Right.
One doctor was saying he got IV Thorazine, and the way he put it is, it made me feel very slow.
What is that?
Thorazine?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a mood stabilizer, antipsychotic. Mm-hmm. And
is it one of the SSRIs or?
No. Okay. It's one of these first generation ones. And he's so this way, when someone comes into the emergency room and they're like really bouncing off the wall, and they, you know, and the aliens and da, 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 it's like, oh, he needs to slow down a little. I got just what you need.
Nice.
You know, so a lot of it is actually, we're going to need Steve's backup here. The urban legend amongst medical students was the first person who did a cardiac catheterization was a medical student on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That put it on itself, just put something to the femoral artery to go all the way up to the heart.
Wow.
So, and I heard he was kicked out of medical school. This could be all urban legend,
what?
But...
Wow, that it would be a shame if that's what happened. Because, I mean, the guy that discovered the bacterial cause of ulcers gave himself ulcers. That's the most famous case, because one of the most famous cases, because he got a Nobel Prize for that. It was Barry Marshall and Robert Warren, and they got an 85 Nobel.
I heard that he lost his medical license.
He did? He had it at the time, I think, yes.
Because
he was very persecuted over it.
Over it, you know, and that's kind of like, what kind of precedent is that set for saying, hey, I think a bacteria lives in hydrochloric acid. Oh, nothing lives in hydrochloric acid. Yeah, you're a quack, you know.
It's, right, right.
You know, it's
because,
like,
of course, we don't know of any organisms that thrive near volcanic vents. Dumbasses.
Exactly. When I was a medical student, I
told just call a bunch of doctors dumbasses. I'm sorry. Sorry, doctors.
I'd like to clear something off my soul right now with you.
Okay.
I think there's a difference between doctors and physicians.
Okay.
I think, you know, it's not the same term in my opinion.
Right.
Because a lot of
go on.
Because a lot of people who are, you know, a lot of people are really medical technicians,
mm-hmm.
and they will follow the flow sheet to the very end, and sometimes tragically to the end.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people who just think.
Mm-hmm.
So a doctor will be able to implement protocols safely and efficiently and give the right medications, but if a plague hits and it's something we never saw before, they're not going to help.
Mm-hmm.
It's the physicians who are going to sit there going, let's take this from square one. Let's bring out the books. What's going on here? What are the symptoms?
So what you're saying is, if you're watching a zombie show or a zombie movie and someone's in there trying to solve it, physician, not doctor.
Yes.
Nice.
I make a distinction. I make a distinction between the two. It's not a popular theory amongst some of my colleagues, but there is a difference between what you do with your knowledge base. And it's going back to what you said about people becoming intelligent in this new generation, this new era of ours. They're not becoming more intelligent. They're just getting faster access to facts.
Mm-hmm.
They have access to facts at a tremendous speed. The whole library.
You have the Library of Congress in your pocket. My kids, I can't even imagine what they're going to be like when they're my age, because they have all this information from birth, basically.
But what do you do with it?
Yeah.
What do you do? It's like, wow, you have all the information, but if you can't apply it...
Right. I'm working on the assumption that my children are smart, right? That whatever intelligence I have, there's some approximation of me, that the apple didn't fall from it. And that maybe I'm smart because you haven't mocked me too viciously. And you have some science certification behind you. But no. I mean, I have to be humble here. But, you know, if you're smart enough and you have that level of access of information, this is the other side of that sword, which is now that there were smart people before who just were cut off from things. They couldn't, you know, they didn't have the financial wherewithal. They didn't have the opportunity. You know, everyone's got a library, but this doesn't mean you're going to find the right book. And you could spend years looking for one little tiny piece of information. Now it's a search, and you can find it in 3 seconds. So you could...
Yeah, but some people don't even know when they find the right book, even when
That's
they
true.
Read it. They don't even know it's the right book for them.
Right, right.
I mean, it's like...
Well, you have facts and then you have ideas. So it's good for ideas for sure. I think that's true. Facts, yeah, that's tougher. In fact, that's what the big fight is right now.
It's like teaching a six-year-old how to drive.
Mm-hmm.
You could stand and say, look, this is a car. There's two pedals. One is faster, one is slower. You turn it this way, it goes right. You turn it this way, it goes left. Mm-hmm. But if you can't see over the board and you can't reach the pedals, it's like,
right.
Thanks for the info, Dad. But you need someone to actually sit in the car and say, okay, yeah, I'm going to hold you in my lap.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't done this with my daughter, so don't pull us over. And keep the child in your lap when you're on private property somewhere where the cops can't pull you over. And you let your daughter drive the car while
right.
you control the gas and the brake. Now you have that guiding force. You have someone who's there right behind you
right.
explaining how to apply the information into a knowledgeable working vehicle.
Okay, so I have a contrary.
You need to sit on daddy's lap to become a physician.
I have an anti-daddy's lap thing here. So two things. One was my experience. So my father's like a master mechanic. I had no idea. Right. My mom and my father divorced. I became friendly with him later as an adult, but I didn't know almost anything about him
okay.
until later when I met with him. By the time I met him, I had already worked as a mechanic by the time I met him again for the first time, I was already working as a mechanic, and I already pulled an engine out of a car.
Wow.
Nobody taught me that.
Wow, wow, wow.
It was just in me, you know? So that's the first thing. So the other thing is, so there was no daddy holding me in my lap. So they're both valid.
Right.
You know, your daughter sitting in your lap and me doing an engine swap were, you know, at 19, without any guidance. I mean, I was raised by my mother and my grandmother, two women who were not mechanically inclined. It just all came from within. You know, and the guy at the auto store, Rip Walter, you know, Walter really helped me out. So, but, you know, you go to the auto store and you'd ask questions and they'd teach you a little bit. So in a way, yes, that's kind of to your point. But it was driven by me. You know, it wasn't driven by him. And also, I saw the most incredible YouTube video. I don't think I brought it up here yet. So, there's a YouTube video, and I'm sure you can find a few of them, but this particular one did a very detailed analysis of the economies of different video games.
Economies?
Economies of video games.
What does that mean?
Like the marketplace and your labor and what the labor pool was and what you...
Currencies, or is it like real
in-game, life? In-game currencies and what you could buy with those currencies. So the entire economy inside of the video game. And lots of different video games have economies. You know, whether they're really obvious, so like some are, you know, you can't even proceed in the video game without buying and selling things, and some are less obvious, like Mario was one of the ones, you know, with the coins. So they actually, one of the coins in Mario, they figured out, I think it was worth $1.34. It's one of the gold coins in a Mario game, based on what you could buy with it. I think it was a game. It might have been game theory.
Like literally $1.34? Like
$1.34.
You have to actually put your credit card down?
The current, yes. So what he did was he did a statistical analysis of all these video games, and he presented it in a way. And my 12-year-old's watching it. I'm like, oh my God, he's watching statistics, applied statistics in economics, and he doesn't even know it.
Is there free will in the video games? Can someone decide to lie?
Well, each video game is different, right? You know,
right.
But yeah, it was based on, yes, you know, in every case, you know, there are some things you have to get some coins as part of missions. You know, you can't walk from here to there without walking through obtaining some kinds of currency, some missions you have to do. But for the most part, it was games where the collection of money was elective. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. So and then what they would do is they could only do it for video games where you could buy things with real world equivalents. So it couldn't just be magical items. You know, it had to be like a potato or a sack of rice or
but could
a
someone,
sword.
Could someone steal the potato or the sack of rice?
No. That was never a consideration in these games.
See, that's what it is. It's like they take the free will out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That would be an interesting thing.
Well, I guess if you killed someone, a lot of video games, yes, if you kill someone, their items will drop. Not all of them. So, like, maybe like it's a 50-50 shot, depending on the game. And that might be a whole of the statistical analysis, but that wasn't even the point. You know, I mean, it was very good. It was thorough. I mean, it was like a 25-minute video. I mean, he's just whipping off the points like this. So you'd have to sit down with a spreadsheet and you'd have to be at it for hours to actually have the numbers in front of you to see what he did. But he did source the numbers, and it was statistical analysis.
That's
on the
awesome.
Economics of video games. And kids are, it's fun, right? Well, which video game character you want to be if you want to be rich? Kids can get into that, right? You know, money's always a motivator, right? You know, it's a good, especially for the immature when you haven't achieved that wisdom yet. And they haven't even begun to build that hierarchy of needs. So, you know, two cases where, all right, again, maybe the person who wrote the video, maybe a little bit of the father, you know, letting the daughter sit in his lap.
Child Protective Services, that was completely just metaphorical.
Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, please.
No, I've known a lot of cops. They're actually humans. You know, they're usually good. We made a lot of jokes about on the show about the black van showing up in the parking lot, but I don't think they're going to show up. I think you're right.
Are those for the cops?
Do you have doctor plates on your car?
Oh, no, I have EMT plates.
EMT. Okay, awesome. Yeah, you're fine.
I am.
You can drive as fast as you want.
I got up a lot of tickets. Not that I drive fast with my daughter in the car.
I went to the wrong field. Or did I? I don't know. All right. Well, anyway, I just... I don't know how we got off into that.
By the way, it's scary. When I went through my EMT course, it's 6 weeks. And it's kind of scary how much they...
Oh, I didn't realize you actually certified as an EMT after you were a doctor.
Right. So between my Romanian medical degree and my DO degree, I had a little stint in which I got my EMT.
Mm-hmm.
But it's amazing how much book it is. And then it's like, and this is how you apply the collar. All right, go to it, guys. And that's, it's amazing how much.
In the software business, they call that fire ready aim.
Okay, that's a very good analogy.
Yeah. Yeah, it's only a few dead people. Mm. Whatever. Ring out, you're dead.
Ding ding.
Oh, you're a Monty Python fan. Nice.
I'm not dead yet. He's almost dead.
Okay, so there was some other things I wanted to bring up. Oh yeah, so we were talking about self-experimentation. So
yes.
Right. That's how we got off on this crazy tangent. This is what happens on the show. This is a great thing about having a long form show, because you just talk, and then you get off on these crazy tangents, and like you talk about things that I never could have guessed. Like, this is not a script. This is just, you see it now, right? Yeah. It's just total chaos. It's just like little signposts in case we're totally lost in the woods, so we can get back to a path where people can not fall in a ditch while they're walking with us.
We are segueing from...
We did watch some shows! Oh,
from topic to topic.
Oh, yes. We're never getting away from the Segways. Did you know that the owner of Segway actually died a year ago on a Segway?
On a Segway.
On a Segway. I think he went off a cliff. I was like, is this The Onion? I don't know. Maybe you could verify that one. Sorry. I'm sorry.
The question is, what was the? Was it like an accident or?
Yeah, I think it was an accident.
Like, I'm sick and tired of this.
I think the inventor. It was the inventor or the current owner. I think it might have been the current owner. Like a year ago, whoever the current owner was a year or two ago.
That must have not been very good for the stock.
I don't understand why it wasn't all over the internet for 3 days straight. It must have been, you know, it's been so crazy lately. Maybe they just, it got lost. It just seems like an April 1st kind of thing. I've probably been duped.
Self-experimentation.
Anyway, enough of the selfie.
Okay, there we go.
All right.
So, a British businessman who bought the Segway company less than a year ago, and this was in 2010, died after riding one of the scooters off of a cliff and into a river near his Yorkshire estate. Jim Heseldon, known locally as Jimmy, acquired the Segway company from the U.S. inventor Dean Kamen in December 2009. And this is written by NBC News.
And
updated September 27th, 2010.
What? Now we know why there aren't Segways everywhere. Come full circle.
Wow. Do you think he was off, or do you think he was doing a publicity stunt?
Well, that's really not good publicity,
it's
is it?
NBC, so.
Yeah, that's what I found too. It looked legit to me. So I'm like, is this real? I mean, I don't know if people just didn't report it because they couldn't believe it. Anyway.
I think this was a European happening instead of like an American, so it wasn't covered by all of our outlets. It was covered by the like, European ones, like BBC and whatever.
Okay, I got it. Okay. Well, you're so deadpan when you read that. That was really good. Good job.
Thank you.
Pickle Rick.
So the thing I wanted to ask you about this is vitamin C and vitamin D. So there's some people out there doing mega doses, and the thing that's really interesting about this is I have a problem with status. You know, people who worship the state as if it's a god and think that the system is infallible, whatever the system happens to be. Which of course they've probably already gotten off of the podcast at this point because we've completely dispelled that myth. But you know, I just seen some terrible arguments where people are angry with people for taking mega doses of C and D, either when they get sick or just in general to avoid getting sick. As far as I can tell, there is no downside to this other than just a lot of peed out C and D.
Well, there's a big downside.
Oh, there is? What's the downside?
Talking about self-experimentations, the first medical fact I read as in my medical career was that the numbers elude me right now, but it was something like if you take more than 4 grams of vitamin C per day, after 3 days, you'll get explosive diarrhea.
Okay.
So I said, that's very interesting. And as a good medical student, I said, what exactly constitutes explosive diarrhea? So I started taking 8 grams a day. It was like a prophecy. On the third day, the gates did open and the flood did cometh. It was pretty horrible.
Wow, really?
I was sitting at my desk here studying.
Right.
And where that chair is, just like 2 meters away, was the toilet.
Mm-hmm.
I basically almost did not make it at all to the bathroom.
Really?
I felt it coming. If I could have been on worldwide TV shaking hands with the Queen of England...
And it wouldn't have mattered.
It would not have mattered. There was no force stopping this.
I think we've all been there.
Corks, no. Corks, crazy glue. Nothing was stopping it. I run to the bathroom.
You pull rank on this, huh?
I pull down my pants before my butt even hits the toilet. It explodes. Now, it wasn't the quantity. It wasn't the velocity. It was the quantity at that velocity, which was truly explosive.
Did you break the ceramic?
No, but I thought I broke the rim. I was rocking back and forth, praying to whatever God would hear me, going, please, I think I busted my sphincter, please. No, I was in so much pain. I really thought I exploded my sphincter.
Right.
It was just warm back there. It was moist. I was afraid to wipe because I was just afraid to have a bunch of blood on my hand.
Wow.
Eventually, 10 minutes later, I manned up, I wiped myself, there was no blood, I took a shower.
So that was C specifically you were doing?
That was vitamin C. So
okay.
Maybe the people who were mad at the people taking mega doses of vitamin C was because they did that at
them.
The Christmas party or something happened with the mega doses.
It's starting to sound like an Ex-Lax prank.
It was, self-experimentation is very important because now I tell my patients, I say, listen, if you're going to do it 500 three times a day or 1,000 twice a day, anything more than 1,000 you poop out, please don't go past 1,000 twice a day.
Nice.
And they look at me, they go, are you okay? Are you having a flashback?
You're there when
I'm
it happens,
there.
Right?
Yeah. So,
that's a great story. I'm so glad I asked about it.
Self-experimentation is very important. But, you know, you could have some vitamin D toxicity.
Right. Well, I know in sunlight, your body can produce, in the most extreme case, up to 50,000.
Depends.
Yeah.
The most people need are arms and legs exposed for about 10 minutes on a sunny day without sunscreen. That's your dose of vitamin C for the day.
Which is about where someone
vitamin D, excuse
never
me.
In the sun and Irish bursts into flame. So having a few Irish friends. Beach ghost. All right. So let's see. So that was not where I thought that was going to go at all.
Pickle Rick.
So, one thing I wanted to see, you did mention PGS, or the press gaining scores. Now, this is like very similar to the net promote scores.
Yeah.
Is that a different scoring system? Is that just the company that's using the NPS system? I really just don't understand what that is. Could you explain it?
No.
Okay. Is it terrible?
You're asking me to go into the psychological profile of the seven dwarfs.
Okay. It's not even real?
it's completely human construct. You're asking me to differentiate, putting two pieces of crap in front of me and saying, well, which one do you think smells better?
Okay, I think we've reached the bottom of the barrel with this physician rating system. So they're the worst.
It's horrible.
Right?
It's horrible.
Yeah.
It's absolutely atrocious.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say how bad this is for the system. And you know what? You watch, and medicine is always a lag before it becomes public knowledge. 6 months go by, a year go by, like patients come in and they go, oh, I just read blah, 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 and blah, 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 and I'm very polite about the whole thing. But it's like, yeah, we knew that like 5 years ago.
Right.
You know, and it just becomes public knowledge after a year. And it was, it's just bloody awful, you know.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
Sorry, it's all this human suffering.
Just
need a little lubrication.
Cheers.
Cheers.
To overcoming human suffering.
All right.
All right.
I believe that whole cheers thing came from where they clinked the glasses, came from the Vikings, so that if any of the glasses were poisoned, they would poison everyone else when they splashed in each other. So
splash
was, yeah, I think that was what I read. I don't know if it's true, but I think it is. I checked it a few times, so.
Is that why they pass a doobie around the circle?
Yeah, maybe.
Is that how that came about? It's like, you go first.
No, I think that's Russian roulette or hot potato, you know, in case the fuzz shows up. I just dated myself with the word fuzz.
Fuzz.
It's the fuzz, run!
Fuzz.
Okay, so it's kind of like a little bit like the Better Business Bureau, it sounds like.
Who?
The scores that we're talking about.
No, there's no better end in the sentence.
The Better Business Bureau is pretty bad. They have a reputation. Basically what they do is if they get complaints, they just lower your score, and then if you pay them off to raise your score back up, so.
Maybe that's how they work, I don't know.
Right.
They're private companies,
so that,
you know.
So what you're saying is that model superior to this. Okay. All right, I don't know. I don't understand it, so I'm kind of lost without you.
So basically, I mean, the way it basically works, if it's a score of 1 to 5 or 1 to 10, depending on the system, and if it's like 1 to 3, you get like negative 100. If you get 4 or 5, if you get a 4, it's a 0. If you get a 5, it's 100.
Mm-hmm.
Or it's like below, it's like 200. It's this really messed up equation that if you get one thing against you, mm-hmm. it just completely throws out statistics. It makes no sense. It's not a pure statistical, like, hey, 5% of the patients think that you're a weenie head. No, no. It's more like your score is your score is like negative 20, but like three people made a comment and one person didn't
right.
like you. So
yeah.
all of a sudden, like, your score is like negative 20.
Well, it's
like,
you know, to use pop culture, it's like the house problem, right? You know, a brilliant doctor that is just a dick because everyone's an idiot around him and he's very frustrated and maybe he has his own social shortcomings, but you know, if you sometimes you got to tell people stuff they don't want to hear, you know, you got to lose weight.
But how messed up is that?
Yeah.
The fact that the people watch a house like show, watch a show like House.
Yeah.
And they really like the character. It's like, oh, it's been on for so many seasons, but they don't want a doctor like that.
Right.
They don't want the smart doctor who just can figure it out and just really has no interest.
I wouldn't have a problem. I would appreciate the brutal honesty.
Me too.
You know, yeah, I mean.
Me too.
Especially if the, you know, is the thing. I think the thing that makes brutal honesty hurt less is time. So the more time you have with your doctor, the more brutally honest they can be, because the more time they have to establish rapport. But if the insurance company is also simultaneously chopping off time you can spend with them, then they don't have time to establish that rapport to give them the brutal truth to keep them actually healthier. So it's almost like a catch-22. You can't get out of it.
The insurance company doesn't do that.
The insurance company doesn't limit the time doctors spend with the patients? Are they just cranking through them to try to pay down their debts? I mean, what's happening there?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The insurance company.
So it's the AMA. It's the AMA limiting the number of doctors and the short number of doctors desperately trying to pay back their enormous student loans, and there not being enough doctors out there.
No, the insurance company basically says we're going to give you this much.
Right.
So it's like, oh man, I gotta keep up. I gotta see, you know, I can't see 20 patients a day anymore. I gotta see 40.
Right.
But it's at the end of the day, it's that, which really sucks.
Right.
You know, but it was that provider's choice, that physician's choice to do that. I was in private practice for 2 years, and every patient, a new patient that came to me, the first time I met a patient was a 1 hour visit.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's so great. Man, I wish you were my doctor. That's great.
Yeah, and I wish I didn't get $20 from your insurance for a 1 hour visit.
Wow.
Like one time I got.
You make a lot more than that.
Yeah.
That's Mickey Mouse, man. That's crazy.
Yeah. So I have. I once got a check in the mail for like it was like 34 cents for the check. I couldn't even afford a stamp to write back a letter saying "F you," based on, you know, that check they gave me.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. So I spent an hour with a patient, and, you know.
Have you thought about just doing a cash practice? I know of at least one ear, nose, and throat doctor in Great Neck that does that.
It's too much headache.
Right, right.
It's just too much headache. I'd rather work for someone else.
He was very good, too. So, you know, I was like, the first time I heard that, I was like, what? You want cash? What are you talking about? Because I was talking to him about possibly doing a surgery, and he wanted cash. But then at another time, I went to him, and I was having an allergic reaction to my blood pressure medication. And my general, who was very good, didn't catch it. But he said, I don't know what's going on. The first thing we got to do is make sure your throat's not going to close tonight. So he sent me to an ear, nose, and throat doctor. And he's like, he didn't even know I was on blood pressure medication. He's like, are you on blood pressure medication? Because my face had swollen up asymmetrically. And he's like, I'm like, yeah. He's like, Ramipril? Yeah. Stop taking it.
There we go.
So that was good. He was worth the money to pay for cash. So I wish more people, I wish people had the disposable income to make those choices, because then maybe there would be some external pressure or competitive pressure on the outside on the insurance company saying, look at these doctors who were successful, have this great reputation. You know, getting kicked off the island might actually end up being better for you, so to speak. You know?
Yeah. Well, look, when I grind...
It's a shame you're not in private practice, I guess that's what I'm saying.
When I did the numbers to make the same money I work making for other people, I'd have to make two times more money. And that means more time in the office, more time with patients, less time with my family. I'm a family man. I love my family above everything else. So
kids are wells. They're endless wells that you can just throw love into and make them better. Even if it's marginally, it's worth it.
Absolutely. And my dedication is completely to my family. Everything else comes second, including medicine. You know, my daughter and my wife are the most important thing to me. My mother, my stepfather, my sister. Everything else is just whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all incidental. It's just things to fill the time before we die.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. Agreed. Well, so you can always make you can make your mark on the world, but I mean, one way that you definitely will make the mark on the world, possibly forever, if things go well, is your kids.
Yes.
Yeah. For sure, you will make a mark on the world with them. So, and then of course you can make other marks too. You know, carve mm-hmm. some stuff in the tree, maybe spray paint some stuff on a stone. But you know, really, they're the ones that are going to be around.
Absolutely.
Your genetics will be around, hopefully in 10,000 years in some form. With your descendants.
I don't think we're going to be around 10,000.
Yeah. Well, actually, so that's great. That's a fork right into immortality. What do you think about the ethics of immortality? I mean, if we get to the, it seems like there's some people saying it seems plausible in our lifetimes that we may even get to the point where we can reverse aging.
Why?
Move your head.
Oh, sorry. You don't think so? You don't think it's worth
no,
it?
No, I'm not saying
it.
Well,
people
fine.
Are going to do it.
Why?
Unless we stop them.
Why?
Because
why would anyone
die?
Why would anyone
death is scary.
To?
The worms crawl in, the
why?
Worms crawl out.
Why? It's the ultimate adventure. It's the I don't want to die,
right.
But I am so looking forward to death.
Right.
It is the next, it's like the Star Trek, the spaceship flying
off
into
space. So what you're
saying
is on your tombstone, you want them to put a sketch in the Enterprise.
That could be doable.
Yeah, actually, that's a good idea, right?
Do you think there's a place
come up with right here.
You think it's like a place that does that?
I'm sure.
Yeah.
You can probably put whatever you want on there. You can probably put a poop emoji if you...
I just pictured someone at the tombstone factory going, oh, God, not on one of these.
Okay.
But I don't understand why someone would want to
be immortal. Have you ever seen the movie In Time?
No.
So that was a good sci-fi movie on this. Like, so, of course, immediately there's a massive overpopulation problem because no one ever dies. Everyone's young and healthy all the time. So what do you do? So what they did was time became currency, and everybody was assigned a certain amount of time at their birth, and then they had to earn it after that. And of course, there's constant inflation. It's harder and harder to earn time as time goes on, and hilarity ensues.
I saw the trailer where he goes 8 minutes for a latte or something like that.
Right.
Is that the movie?
Yeah, that's the movie.
I did see a series. It's really great. It's about a guy who's a soldier who gets killed, who gets brought back at a time where people swap into different bodies.
Mm-hmm.
You know that show? It's on, I think it's one of these Hulu or Amazon originals.
No, I don't.
It's really a great series. It's about people who could transfer, they could back up their consciousness, and if they die, they download their...
This is a Black Mirror. This is a Black Mirror episode.
Not Black Mirror. It was something
Black
else.
Mirror did this, too. So they had a big database where people could go in and out of a shared virtual reality.
Altered Carbon, that's it.
Okay, cool, nice.
Yeah. Did you see that one?
I did not see that one.
Yeah, I highly recommend it.
Altered Carbon, okay.
It has a lot of these ethical issues, dilemmas, and moral aspects to it.
Okay.
It's more like a detective, but they touch on these things.
Right. Cool, I'll check that out.
Yeah, but immortality, the problem is we're rapidly, we live inside a closed system.
Right.
This planet is a closed system.
Right.
We only have a limited amount of resources.
Of course.
I think we should all live our life.
Right.
Be happy and die happy.
Right.
And give the next generation a shot. There's no reason why we should all become immortal, consume resources unlimited, and take away from the other generations.
You can literally... So, I completely agree with you, but I had to hear it from you. And see what you thought on it. I tell my kids that, from the beginning, when they were forming their archetypes about death, I was like, at some point, the people who are here have to die and move on so that you can, use the resources and take up the space. Now, I think a lot of the numbers that are out there are inflated. I don't think we're going to... I've seen numbers as low as 12 billion where we're going to have problems on the planet. I saw numbers that seemed credible to me, 40 billion. But yes, there is definitely a limit where the amount of people on the planet hits a resource limit. And even if technologies come along, hopefully we'll be able to leave the planet and terraform others before that happens, and we won't face the ethical dilemma of restricting population growth.
I hope not.
Yeah, I hope we can avoid it because.
No, I hope we don't leave the planet.
Go on.
I really hope we don't go to colonize other worlds, because okay. Until
Mars is just a rock, man.
Oh, that's fine. Mars is fine. I don't mind.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
No, Mars is fine.
Martians, man. You know, Martian rights.
I thought you meant those new planets they found.
Like Earth type planets.
Earth type planet. I don't think we should go to Earth type planets.
Mm. Okay.
Because we haven't figured out our shit here.
Right.
It's like if we just want to go because we're outrunning our resources to the next planet.
Yeah.
We just basically became viruses in the universe.
Yeah.
Going to the next place to consume the resources.
Right.
To the
Never
next
actually
planet.
Solving the problems.
Right.
Balance.
So once I'm all for it. Once you get that balance of problems, once we're okay with it, then yeah, we'll explore, go to different places.
That's fair.
But not until then.
I have a first contact protocol. So all right. So a lot of people are. This is something that's getting explored now. We're starting to think about the planet as a type 1 civilization. And okay, what if we're just a species and we have to deal with the universe as a species? You know, not a lot of people are on board with this, but it's more than zero, which is an improvement. And thinking about, okay, if you're an alien, let's suppose that there are spacefaring aliens. They're probably here already, in my opinion. If there's spacefaring aliens and space travel is technologically possible, let's say warp fields are the answer and Star Trek had it right all along, just as one possible example, or wormholes, or there's a thousand things. They're probably just outside of our periphery of our ability to scan them, and they're watching us, and they're waiting for something to happen, for some indication of when we reach that point where we do have balance, where we're no longer out of control and no longer a virus, waiting to blight the universe, where we wouldn't intrude on another life space, and to help us then, to share their technology and to share the resources of the local universe with us. So
are they that bored? They hang around watching us?
Why not?
I mean, come on, it's like we're from the future.
Well,
so
we're almost getting there now ourselves, right? I mean, you're very busy, right? But what's happening in a lot of other fields is that a lot of things, people like me are coming along and automating jobs away. You know, the jobs are becoming, you know, this. We are not in a labor glut yet, but there's a risk of one. It is on the horizon. You know, I mean, we could have a sudden labor glut. You know, we're a few algorithms away, theoretically. So if that happens, you know, I won't even say it would be a new event. If the current event continues on the current track, you know, and the automation starts eating into the job market, we may find ourselves a species with a whole lot of free time and nothing to do. Now, if you have space faring capability and it isn't too expensive energy wise, it would just be like people who go to the rainforest to look at frogs. You know, there would be aliens that would come and look at us and, hey, what are they doing?
You know, my theory about aliens is that they're really not extraterrestrials.
Right.
They're terrestrials from the future.
That's possible, too.
I think it's a lot easier to rip a hole in time and space.
Right.
Yeah, stick to the good stuff. rip a hole in time and space and see yourselves rather than traveling across the cosmos and watch a bunch of monkeys try to figure out their problems.
Right, right.
You know, you travel across a galaxy and you, it's like, let's wait to see what they do. If they get it right, we'll step in. Like, you know, from the physician mentality, my thing is like, wow, look at them. They're heading for badness. Maybe I should tell them.
Right.
Why
right.
would they say like?
So you're saying it would be for an ethical creature, it would just be torture, watching another species slowly evolve towards becoming an equivalent, a peer species.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's like,
what are you doing? Don't do that!
Like, who the hell...
Why are you lighting nuclear weapons off on your planet?
who do they piss off to get the job to watch the humans evolve?
Right.
Sitting on a station going, oh, God. What the hell are they doing now? It's like, oh, I shouldn't have called that guy an a-hole.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I think it's, you know, based on our...
That's very Douglas Adams of you.
based on the theories I hear about, you know, quantum physics and time travel, there's a non-interference issue.
Yeah.
I think if we go on the fact that we establish this as a law to not interfere if we develop time travel, that makes sense why aliens come and don't say anything, because we're just not, don't interfere, just watch. Mm-hmm. Observe the monkeys. This is where we came from. Just like when people go to the zoo, it's like,
right.
I went to the zoo, I don't like zoos, but I went to the zoo, and I never spoke with a monkey. I never started speaking with a monkey. And
right.
I think aliens are the same. They came to see us, look at the monkeys, and...
So I did a thing on my site, we have a couple of economic, talked about a couple of economic theories based on the Capuchin monkey study, where they had currency. Yeah, that was a thing where the Capuchin monkeys were taught to use currency, and then it was an accident, and they spilled the money into the cage. Back, you know, had a basket of money.
This is real money?
Coins, yeah. It took them 6 months to teach them how to use money to get food and stuff.
Okay.
So they were trying to, economists were doing this. They were trying to see if there was like some inherent human behavior. And the Capuchin monkeys, they dropped the, like there was a basket full of coins or something, it just fell in the cage by accident.
By accident, okay.
By accident.
All right. Okay.
So the monkeys immediately went, all the male monkeys went and grabbed the coins and then started paying the female monkeys in exchange for sex. So basically, when left their own devices, the first thing they did was prostitution.
Yep.
So anyway, I got that from Rogan, actually. He was on. He did it in a comedy bit. He misrepresented it, but that's more or less what happened.
I think it was bananas. I think that's what the case was.
No, it definitely was coins.
It was regardless,
great. Capuchin monkeys are like sugar, so that was the coins were traded for sugary treats. That
Capuchin
was the,
monkeys.
That was the economy.
Are they like acidophilus monkeys?
So we went to.
Kombucha, acid alphas, get it? No. No.
Okay.
Probiotics? No.
Oh, okay.
Kombucha. Yeah. Anywho. Pickle Rick!
Pickle Rick. So we went to San Diego, and there was a Kombucha monkey exhibit there.
Okay.
And my family's watching the monkeys. I completely ignored the monkeys and talked to a human, because there was a zookeeper there, and I wanted to discuss the Kombucha monkey, so.
There we go.
I kind of like... It's really a roundabout way to say I agree with you. I went to the zoo and ignored the most interesting thing there. So
yeah.
I could talk to a human. They just happened to be standing there and was also interested in the monkeys.
Yeah.
Well, anyway.
But just the whole alien thing. I believe in the extraterrestrials. You know,
I mean, it's plausible.
Just,
I don't know.
It's very
I don't
plausible.
Know if this is a singularity. I don't know if this.
I just don't understand what they would be doing here watching us. That's all. It's like.
Right, right.
It's like how much can you sit at the zoo watching animals, you know, until you get bored out of your mind? Like I gotta go do something else, you know.
Right, right. I don't know why people collect stamps. I don't get it. I completely don't get it. It just seems like the most boring thing in the world to me. Or coins, you know, not like valuable coins where it has some intrinsic value or has some historical, but just like, you know, want to have every single quarter that was ever minted. Yeah, I just don't get it. It just seems incredibly boring to me. But, you know, someone's really into that. Or toy trains, right? You know.
How would you feel if you were taking apart the mothership and all the aliens come up to you and go, want to see my stamp collection? Like, what?
I guess that's kind of what's going.
Can you please just anal probe me and let's make this interesting?
I think I know what one of the images in your title card is going to be.
Well,
stamp with an alien on it. all right, so let's see. There's lots of things we can talk about. So biometrics. Oh, so what are your feelings on any input or thoughts on biometrics?
Like
using biological features to authenticate yourself with computer systems.
Mixed feelings. You know,
okay.
Because there's always going to be some a-hole out there who wants to do something with the information.
Mm-hmm.
I have no problem with, you know, scanning my retina or my fingerprint. I just don't like... I mean, we already do it,
mm-hmm.
right? The, you know, these phones with the fingerprint ID.
Mm-hmm.
You really don't know where those fingerprint information goes.
Yes. Okay. You're thinking.
You don't. You don't. It goes somewhere into,
yeah.
you know, we don't know it sits on the phone. And again, with the aliens, what the hell are you going to do with it?
Right,
it's
right.
It's like, oh, we got Kachoba's fingerprint. It's like, okay, pick
yeah.
a Rick. What are you going to do with it? You know, it's like.
So, the problem with biometrics. So the thing is, biometrics were originally used as high-end security as part of a multi-security platform in, like, high confidence kind of situations for government stuff.
Right.
So where the only time someone would have stolen it, the only time that you would ever be able to use it for anything was if like a spy were to steal it so they could get into, you know, a research facility or something
yeah.
like that. So but of course now we have fingerprint scanners, and now there's even optical scanners are becoming more prevalent. So this ties back to de-identified genetic data, don't worry. So I didn't just go off on a pier. Well, I kind of did, but I'm walking towards land. So as a geek, I'm constantly warning people, don't give people your genetic data. Don't give people your bio. Don't give them your fingerprints. Don't give them your eye prints. Don't give them your genetics. And of course,
that's going to ruin a lot of people's dating lives.
It is. Well, aside from one night stands and turkey basters, I was thinking more along the lines of going to one of those genetic heritage sites, you know, and putting in your genetic code. You know, now they have your genetics in digital form. You know, and you're completely depending on their data team to get it right forever, right? Because they're not going to delete that stuff.
No. Nope.
You know, I mean, they may say they are, and they may actually do it, but if they don't say they're going to, they're not going to delete it. They're going to keep it forever because that has value, and the companies don't throw away value ever if they don't have to. So the problem with biometrics is they don't ever go away. So a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of focus right now on HIPAA and making, I wanted to share a story from you from a scientist at Rockefeller. A lot of HIPAA compliance things focusing on keeping the de-identification process secure and the de-identified data, you know, the identified data versus the de-identified data completely separate and not, they never shall touch. So I was at a meeting in Rock, and one of the genetic scientists said, well, you know, this is, we were talking about the HIPAA requirements, and of course, you know, at one level, you're just trying to satisfy the law. You're just trying to not get, keep Johnny Law off your case and not create a problem. And he's like, you know, it doesn't really do that much because we're already at the point now where I can look at someone's DNA and say, oh, that's that guy, because there's enough unique identifiers in the DNA, you know, oh, he's a brunette, oh, he's got blue eyes, oh, he's Caucasian, he's about 5'8", you know, okay, he's a medium build, you know, probably not that heavy, definitely doesn't have this disease or that disease or this disease or that disease, looks like he's about this old, right? And so if you can do that, the de-identified data becomes the identified data. So there's all this data out there that we're presuming to be safe that we're mixing up together, and it may come to a point where that genetic fingerprint is completely reversible instantaneously. So I have no idea what the implications of that are. I was just wondering if you had heard this before, or
no, but it's kind of, you know what, there's always going to be the antithesis to what you're striving to do. Okay, first of all, just to backtrack a little bit, I don't want to interrupt you.
No, it's fine.
Retina scans and fingerprints scare the crap out of me personally,
right,
especially if I work for the government, because there's going to be someone walking around with my eyeball on my hand,
right,
up to a scanner, you know. So it's like, what's the point? You know, you could still get someone's fingerprint if you...
Fingerprints are easy. You know, especially with physical access, that's simple. You can do it with scotch tape and dust.
No, or they could just cut off the finger. And just
finger.
That's what I'm trying to get at.
Oh,
you know?
Okay. Cut off the finger.
You know, it's very romantic in the movies with the scotch tape and the
right,
mist
right,
and the stuff. They're just going to take your finger, you know, to go
right,
do what
right,
they got to do. I'm sorry, I backtracked and I have to... forward track.
Right,
we
right. So we're talking about biometrics, and I was talking about genetic reversibility.
You know what's going to happen? I'll tell you right now what's going to happen. If it gets to that point, there's going to be people out there.
Oh, it's getting there already.
But it's going to be people who are going to say, what's the next step? You know what? Buy my virus, and it will go into your cells, and they can't read your genes anymore. That's what's going to happen.
That was very good.
It's going to happen. There's always going to be someone who's going to know how to overcome the system or loop the system somehow.
Right.
And they're going to do it for money too.
So this got me about how genetic scientists work. So what do? When they're interested in a particular gene sequence, they fluoresce the genes, right? So they add in markers, and then those markers will actually glow in the dark.
Yeah, it's pretty trippy looking.
Yeah, and they'll be able to shine a light on them and be able to spot them in the actual DNA after they've added, you know, they CRISPRed it in or something. So that got me thinking. Okay, so as we start creating designer babies, we're actually going to start seeing people adding in the same genes over and over and over again. So at some point, having certain genetic markers is going to mark you as a blue blood, and can actually make you vulnerable. You know, if you're in some de-identified database, you may also be able to identify someone from their de-identified genetic data.
Yeah.
Based on income. Because, you know, oh, they can afford these three. Oh, they can afford these six. Oh, they can afford these 10. You know, when they're creating their designer baby. And then that gives you some idea of what their wealth is. So
what's the difference between that and having a prestigious name?
Well, yeah.
Well, it's like, he's a fill-in-the-blank Rockefeller, or Kennedy. It's like, well, there's your blue blood.
Conversely, you could get to a point where, the equivalent of the French mobs during the French Revolution, you know, most activism now is, you know, hackers, right? I mean, I was just talking about it with Lee. Beto O'Rourke was in a hacker group. He's caught. You know, nobody seems to be talking about it. They're not covering it in the press. But yeah, he was in a very famous hacker group that had meaningful financial damages against random companies because they were, you know, they were trying to get Microsoft to fix their bugs. So they were trying to do a good thing, but maybe, you know, a less ethical path to do it. But hacktivism is real, and it's getting bigger. I mean, we have a hacktivist running for president of the United States. You know,
who's that? So,
Beto O'Rourke. The guy from Texas.
Let me put this to you in reference to where I am at.
Right.
I had a patient yell at me because I didn't know who Joe Biden was.
Okay.
Okay. She's like, my friend just had dinner with Joe Biden. I looked at her, all honesty in my heart, I said, who's Joe Biden? And she goes, the Vice President of the United States. And she starts yelling at me like, whoa. It's like I don't know. I don't follow politics.
No, it's fine. That's fine. It doesn't matter who he is.
No, but he's a hacker?
But he's a hacker, yeah. So one of the front-running Democratic presidential candidates is a hacker, is a caught red-handed hacker. So, and a hacktivist, so he isn't just hacking for money, you know, he's hacking to try to change the world.
You know, I never voted in my life, but he might be the first one I vote for.
Interesting. You know, a lot of people seem to be having that reaction, and it's weird because I'm isolated in the computer field, and I spend a lot of time defending against attacks, and, you know, people are coming in from the internet, trying to take over servers and take over campuses and coming into the network, and they're... And the security guys are cursing them out under their breath, and I can't believe these guys, they're terrible, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter what their motivation is. You try to have that conversation with them, they're like, I don't care. It's wrong, you know?
Right, yeah, different archetypes.
That's right.
Different personalities, absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, so I just thought I'd get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, and just for the record, I'm not anti-democratic.
Yeah, yeah.
I believe in a free society. I'm probably more democratic than other people. It's just there's no one has come along yet to motivate me to get out of my chair.
Right.
You ever listen to Bill Hicks?
No, I understand. Oh yes, I love Bill Hicks.
Like,
he's awesome.
I'll vote for the puppet on the right. I'm gonna vote for the puppet on the left. Wait, there's one guy in the middle. It's like, go to sleep, America.
Version with the two tentacle monsters after they take their masks off.
Yeah, it's all the same to me. It's like no one has motivated me.
Right.
And I challenge them. I challenge a politician to actually get me off a seat, to actually spend my day to go vote.
I hate to say this, but they don't care about you.
No,
unless you're donating, they don't care about you.
And that's perfectly fine.
You're too far on the edge. You're away at the edge of the periphery, and they're like, whatever. We'll never get him.
And that's perfectly fine.
Yeah.
And that's perfectly fine with me.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you know, respect my personal beliefs.
They don't care
beliefs.
About me either. I can't even think of a single candidate that's represented all my views.
The only person who's cared about is the Bitcoin AI. I know it cares about me.
Singularity for president.
Singularity. You know what? I would vote for singularity.
I, for one, welcome the singularity.
Well, let's see how many presidents we had until now. How many humans we had? I don't see what.
The only person that scares me isn't a person at all. Nice. So let's see. What else was there that I wanted to talk about?
I heard maybe Steve could back us up on this. I heard a lot of people go into the voting booths and they vote for Batman and Superman and Spider-Man.
Last year, Harambe was the big one.
Who was it?
Harambe.
Who's Harambe?
Do
you know about the Harambe thing? Harambe was like an internet. that meme. He was a gorilla that got killed
in its booth
because it was like dragging a kid through like its exhibit because a kid fell in. So then there's a whole like, internet motion. It's like
he hadn't actually hurt the kid yet. They were just worried he was going to.
Yeah, so I'm not
going to
say the term that they use. You can Google that. But Harambe was like this viewed as this big icon. And then when people didn't want to vote for Hillary or Trump, they went into the booth and they wrote in Harambe.
Nice.
And I think he was the number one write-in.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. If I knew he was running, I would have voted for him.
It's like, there's definitely a supervillain in the Batman universe, in the DC universe, where that was a gorilla. I forget what his name was.
Krog, I think.
Yeah.
By the way, I really feel bad about that gorilla. They didn't have to kill the gorilla.
Really?
They don't have tranquilizers in the zoo.
Yeah, that's silly. I agree with you. He probably was just going to cuddle the kid, right? Because all mammals are have
that cute... He was actually like holding the kid by the like dragging it through the exhibit.
Oh, he was dragging it?
It was like dragging the kid.
Although, okay, I didn't realize there was actual danger. I thought he was just...
No, he was fine. He was dragging, but it wasn't like hostily dragging. It was just dragging...
It was like through water and stuff.
Yeah, but I think it was...
The gorilla probably didn't realize there was any... Because a gorilla baby would probably not have a problem with that.
Yeah. It was probably like, well, it's kind of like weak for like a non-gorilla baby, you know? But I don't think the gorilla meant
What is harm. With this weird, sickly, pale gorilla? Very strange. I have to bring it over here to protect it.
I think everyone... who was watching should have just thrown their weed and their CBD in the pit. Let the gorilla eat it until it passed out.
Whoa,
I mean,
man. Is this really happening?
Oh, look at this hairy baby chimp.
Hey, who knows? Maybe that's how people got started. You never know. Once we figured out fire.
Do you know, actually, one of the... Steve, help us out. Mm-hmm. There was actually someone who... I heard that they did research. They found some monkeys on the border with the desert and the jungle.
Yeah.
The researchers noticed they were flipping over rocks. And they're like, they're eating something. And once they went to examine it, there were psychotropic mushrooms they were eating.
Ah, cool.
So the theory is that there were some monkeys living in an area with a lot of psychotropic mushrooms.
And that's
how we made the next jump.
Oh. So they're not the only animals either. So there's definitely monkeys that look for partly decomposed grapes or fruits.
Fruits.
For the alcohol content. There's actually alcoholic monkeys in nature. And although I don't know if they would call it alcoholic, I don't know if they're addicted, but they definitely seek it out. And also reindeer. So you know in Mario, the little the red and white speckled mushrooms. There's actually mushrooms like that in Northern Europe, and reindeer seek them out to trip. That's where the flying reindeer comes from.
Is that why Grandma got run over?
That's where the Santa Claus flying reindeer thing comes from.
Oh, my God.
It's from tripping reindeer eating psychotropic mushrooms.
That's so trippy. By the way, I like to make a little footnote here.
And that's also where piss comes from. I don't know if you know that.
Piss?
Yeah.
Like what?
So that particular kind of mushroom, people would eat it, and then if your body would, it has a bunch of other toxins in it, but your body can't process the psychotropic molecule. So if you piss it out and then drink it again, it's actually more intense the second time. So that's where getting pissed comes from. That's the origin of that.
That's really trippy.
It is literally trippy.
You know, because there are a lot of shamans and gurus who recommend drinking urine.
Right.
But
by the way, I don't recommend drinking urine. Thank you.
By the way, I recommend drinking urine. Thank you.
Nice.
And medical advice, just a personal recommendation. There is to drinking urines.
They're fluids.
But, you know, to make a little footnote, there is heavy, heavy interest. There is a movement being spearheaded by a neuropsychiatrist called Dr. Engel. I met him at a medical conference.
Okay.
He is actually spearheading the movement to have the FDA actually allow phase 3 trials for psychotropic medications.
Mm-hmm.
LSD. psilocybin from shrooms. Mm-hmm. And ketamine is still used in the hospitals, but they want to use it for psychotropic reasons. Mm-hmm. These medications in the 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, someone came along, some suit came along and said, oh, all these are bad. Let's just make them Schedule One, just take them off the market.
Right.
With the reefer heads and, the reefer's bad. And this
Schedule One are the worst kinds of drugs, you know, and even though they're not.
Or the best kind of drugs.
Legally, they're the worst kind of drugs, but it doesn't necessarily mean that any medical connection at all to that.
No. Actually, the FDA recently approved a phase 3 trial.
That's it, because I got to drive home at some point.
Sorry, we're not driving. We're actually already at his house.
Right. So. I can sleep in my car. Go ahead.
He does that often. He sleeps in his car. In his own driveway with the keys not in there.
Yeah, well, now that I can say anything I want about my wife, because she's sworn she's not going to watch the show, so I'm like, all right, it's on then.
Like Donkey Kong.
Like Donkey Kong.
And they actually approved a phase 3 trial for psilocybin mushrooms in refractory depression.
Right.
I was speaking to one emergency room doctor.
Oh, really?
I know
a guy who's all about psilocybin.
He actually had a patient who came in, and the patient said, I want to kill myself. Legit, I have a plan. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I am truly suicidal. He's like, oh, this guy's going to off himself.
Right.
So he has.
Guys are usually more successful, too, right?
Unless they're physicians. If they're physicians, men and women are equal.
Oh, okay.
That's equal lethality.
Equal lethality.
So he leaves the emergency room, he leaves the emergency room for 24 hours, he has his next day off, he comes back. The guy's still in the bed. They can't get a psych consult at that hospital. The psychiatrist hasn't shown up. Mm-hmm. And this guy still wants to kill himself. And he's like, what the hell am I going to do? You know, this guy's just sitting here, you know? So then he remembers reading something about...
like bureaucracy to lighten your spirit.
That's right.
Life's worth living.
And I really applaud him for doing this. Kudos to him. He said, you know, I read something about ketamine used in depression and suicidality. And he actually gave him IV ketamine in the emergency room. Mm-hmm. And a few hours later, the patient said, can I go home? He's like, well, are you going to kill yourself? He's like, no, I have no idea what I was thinking about. I don't want to kill myself. I want to live. And I've actually met patients who are on ketamine infusion once every 2 weeks. I mean, these are like real, like these are patients with...
For what? For depression or for something else?
For suicide attempts. These are people with really deep scars, mm-hmm, who really understood that they're...
I've had friends like that.
No, really deep scars. Not the cutters who just want to feel.
Yeah, I've had friends.
You know, and this is one patient that keeps coming to mind, but she gets ketamine infusions every 2 weeks, and she's like, this is the only thing that keeps me in here. You know, this is the only thing that keeps me in this life. I can't, without this, I will kill myself. So, and it takes a physician to have the balls or the...
Right.
Neutral politically correct genitalia for this conversation.
The gonads. Gonads are safe.
Gonads. Thank you.
Yeah.
To have the gonads to say, you know what, this guy's laying here, I'm going to try the ketamine.
Yeah.
A doctor wouldn't do it. A doctor's like, I'm going to wait for a psychiatrist. Maybe it's a week. I don't care.
Right.
A physician's like, I'm going to try the ketamine. Let's roll the dice. Let's see what happens.
Right. Good. Excellent.
Yeah.
It's so refreshing when you see someone who's being brave for the sake of someone else.
Oh, it's great.
A great story. That is like a beautiful story.
It's a beautiful story when things go right.
Right,
when
right.
When things go wrong,
right.
You are...
He's finished. Yeah.
Two times in residency, I went completely opposite against ACLS protocol, Advanced Cardiac Life Support.
Okay.
You know, the American Heart Association Life Support. And it has very, you know, it has little boxes with, if the patient does this, if the patient does that, you give this medication or you shock. And there are two patients where I did exactly the opposite of what ACLS protocol did. The patient survived. I documented in my chart, this is how the code ran. I put my name on it. I went against ACLS protocol at this step in the code because of reasons A, B, C, D. Mm-hmm. You know, this is why I did it.
Right.
I put my stamp and I put my signature on it. I stepped up to the plate.
Because that crap could be in court later. So you had to do that.
Court. I was a resident. I could lose my job.
Okay. You're done as a doctor.
Good luck finding another job. You
wow.
Know?
Well,
why were you fired? I went against ACLS protocol. Well, you know, go against it somewhere else. You
stupid
have to
is, stupid does.
Yeah.
Wow, that's really brave.
You know, yeah. So it was great because, cheers. It was great because everyone's like, well, you did the right thing, you did the right call. Mm-hmm. But if the patient did not live, mm-hmm. there's only one doctor I know who would have said you did the right call, even though the patient died. Everyone else, I'm pretty sure, would have crucified me.
So this is, you know, this is one of the things I tell my kids all the time, you know, and is you have to be strong to be good. It's not enough to want to do good in the world. You actually have to have the strength, whether it's intelligence as strength.
Right.
But, you know, you have to have the will, the force, the knowledge, the ability. It's not just enough to just, I want to be, you know, good intentions pave the road to hell, but... You have to really know your stuff. You have to study and you have to understand it. I mean, it sounds like you went through medical school twice. So, yeah and EMT. So, yeah. You get to see the whole picture. Yeah. And do you have to do two residencies too? Or?
No, just one residency.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. I don't know if you had to do a residency. Huh?
Yeah, so I got my MD degree. Mm-hmm. I came back to the States. I got married. I got divorced. I went through dysthymia. Before I knew it, literally 5 years of my life just like poof, up and vanished. And I said to myself, okay. You're at the crux in your life. If you really love medicine, you love what you do, and you want to help people, you have to go back to school.
Right.
No one's hiring anyone after 5 years. You're too far out. You're too far away. You could have perfect board scores. You could be the best person in the world. But if it's 5 years out, no one's hiring you. So it's like make a decision, man up, make a decision, live with it. And I did, and I said, I'm going back to school.
Yeah, you know, doing this show is actually kind of scary because I can't really do this. I mean, maybe I can at some point, but right now, you know, it looks like maybe I can't do this and work full time, and I'm already 2 years out. So I would say probably 5 years is also the limit in the computer tech field.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. No, like that's about when you get to the point where people are like, you know, there are always external events, like Y2K was a good example. They were pulling people out of retirement because they just needed bodies to just look through code for Y2K compliant problems. But generally speaking, yeah. Once you get about 5 years out, they're like, yeah, you don't know what's going on anymore. You know, perhaps I'd be an exception because I have this show and because we're constantly talking tech. But yeah, there's a lot of ageism also in the computer field. So.
Really, how is it in the computer field? Is it more like the silverbacks get the respect?
Well, if you're employed, yes, but also at the same time, people just. The great thing about the computer field is you have to be smart. There's no excuse. It doesn't matter what schooling you have. You can't credential your way into things. I mean, you can get the job, but you can't keep it. You know, you have to actually legitimately be smart. So, and companies and HR departments and companies eventually figure this out after they get smacked upside the head a few times. And, you know, people don't work out.
If you think they get it after that.
All right, well, you know. Well, let's put it this way. Because there's so much leverage in the computers, it's often a multi-million dollar event when it goes really wrong. So, yeah, they do get smacked upside the head. Maybe not by the IT department, maybe by somebody who was affected by the event, other than the IT department. But, yeah, someone smacked them upside the head. And, you know, you got to get someone who knows what they're doing. You can't just go by their, you know. But with that in mind, companies love to hire young guys. Because they're willing to work 50, 60, 70 hours and drive themselves into the ground.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they burn out in their 30s and they're done.
No, but the first 7 seconds, like Steve brought up, it's like, hi, I'm so-and-so. Do they look at you and go, they look at someone and go, wow, look, he has, you know.
He's hungry.
He's gray hair. He's knowledgeable. Oh. You know, the professor has the gray hair, you know, is very.
Yeah, there's some
know,
of that. There's some
or
of
is
that.
It more like.
We're getting more towards that. So I think when I was younger, there was originally everybody worked for the same company their whole life.
Right.
And then now we're like everyone's changing companies every 3 to 5 years, which is a huge problem with ageism in the IT industry. But now that number is still shrinking, so it's getting to the point where it's almost ridiculous. Like whenever there's a labor shortage, they just, screw it, whatever. Just you know they're not legally allowed to be ageist, you know, and they just But you know there's still some of it, but I think it's improving. I think we're gonna get. I just don't know why there's this idea that you can't teach an old dog new tricks. I mean, it's one. There's also two different paths into the IT industry. One is where you're getting certifications,
right.
You're learning about things, and you're testing out for specific skills that are relevant at the moment. And then there's another path, which is computer science or something like that,
yeah.
or a relevant math program. And then you just get the degree and you're done. So if there's a little more truth to it if it's a technician route, because they may not have been able to understand the core concepts, which is why they avoided the college. If you go through the college, you understand the concepts, then, if you understand how to compare algorithms and say which one is the best one for the job, then that's something that applies no matter what the computer language is. It doesn't matter. It's still an algorithm. You're still comparing the output. You have this input field, you have that output field, and this one's more efficient than that one. If you depend on, this company's tech, a popular one is Cisco. Cisco makes all the routers and the network gear. And they've actually converted some of the Cisco certifications into college courses. And they made it reasonably objective, but a lot of it is the vendor stuff. And that's actually starting to burn guys in the networking field now, because they're starting to build more non-Cisco. Linux is starting to intrude in the networking field, and there's Linux-based network appliances out there.
Interesting choice of words.
Well, Cisco owned it. Basically, they owned the network space. But, they're constantly raising their prices. They raise their prices a little. Some people leak over to the Linux space, to the open source kind of free space where there's
competing
vendors. Well,
free will, competition.
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing that sucks is for the guys that went the technical certification route, especially the lower end ones. The high end ones are still very sought after, but the lower end ones are like, this isn't as easy to get a job anymore because I have to work on different equipment than what I was trained on. So if you train to the equipment. So this actually brings up something interesting. I had an idea for, I wrote a sci-fi book.
Yeah.
About the birth of nanotech into society. And of course,
nice.
I made it a medical thing because I see that as the main driver for any kind of bottom-up nanotechnology. If you're building it if you're building a machine at the nanoscale, it's going to be medicine because the amount of good that you can do is untold. Right, you can deliver to the exact cells you're interested in, you can deliver the exact payloads you're interested in, or remove whatever molecules you're interested in. Assuming that you had the gatage on the nanite to do it, to recognize, okay, this molecule is this one, I don't want that one. When I was working out this idea, a lot of some people in the book are sick, and that's one of the reasons, that's how the relationships all start up.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I realized, I didn't actually put it in the book, but I realized that this seems almost inevitable. So right now we have all these technological silos like MRI or X-ray or the technician that works on the cardiac equipment, I don't know, what's the EKG, or the EKG technician, or you have, and people work on these very narrow fields. Well, in a nanotech world, it's more bottom up, right? You have one platform, and that's the technology you need to do everything, to do monitoring, to do delivery, to do removal. So at that point, it seems almost like you'd have technician-doctor pairs that would work together all the time and never essentially be partners, in every medical situation, because it seems to me that it would be at least as complicated as the computer technical world, right, with servers and networks and, different network protocols and, possibly encryption. I don't know if it would work at that scale, if the computers would be fast enough. But, some kind of security, for sure. So it would have its whole own field, and then medicine would have its own field. It just seems to me like it would be not a lot of people who could do both at the same time and keep up with both at the same time. So you would almost, to partake in modern medicine, you'd have to, when we switch to a single platform, you'd have to switch to a doctor and a computer technician side by side. I'm curious what you think about that. If you see any of that happening now, any ideas? Right, wrong, possible, plausible, improbable?
I'll give you an example that I give to my pupils, to whoever would listen to me.
Okay. I'm listening. We're all listening.
So people who want to go to medical school, I give them this great example that I had. I had a colleague come to me, ask me a second opinion about a patient.
Right.
Patient had documented, proven in the office, influenza.
Mm-hmm.
The flu. She had the flu.
Right.
Lung exam was clear, this and that, you know, coughing, some expectorations. Alrighty, fine. And she comes back 2 weeks later because she has a fever.
Mm-hmm.
On the review systems, when you ask the review systems, what we ask patients, other than their chief complaint, we ask them, well, do you have diarrhea? Do you have this? Do you have that? On her review systems, she had no cough. She had no phlegm. She had some muscle aches. You know, her right hip was hurting, but she had this fever going on. And the provider did an X-ray. Mm-hmm. And the way I start this conversation with my students is like, why are X-rays dangerous?
Well, radiation.
So that's the trick question for them, and that's what exactly what they say. It's not the X-rays that are dangerous. It's the. Let me step back a second. So we do an X-ray on this patient.
I got it wrong.
The patient has pneumonia. Don't worry, everyone gets it wrong.
Okay.
The patient has pneumonia.
Right.
No. I'm sorry. Excuse me. Let me back up. The patient has an infiltrate. Something shows up on the X-ray.
Okay.
A patch.
Okay.
That looks like pneumonia.
Okay.
Right. And this you could answer me if you think AI will pick up on this. They said, well, what should we do with this patient? Now, what do you think the computer would do, speaking from AI?
Well, if it recognized the machine learning, if it recognized the patch as a possible a pneumonia,
right.
it would say this person needs to be put on oxygen, be put into the ER, monitored to make sure that they're breathing sufficiently,
mm-hmm.
and that's it for, you know, and then more testing, you know, blood tests.
Exactly. Spot on, correct. Now
I went through this with my mom, so I know the answer.
But however, here's the issue.
Right.
The patient has a fever, but the patient does not have a cough. The patient has no phlegm or expectoration.
Mm-hmm.
The patient's lung sounds are clear.
Right.
The radiographic signs of pneumonia last up to 10 weeks. So 4 weeks after I have pneumonia, let's say I have pneumonia, I get antibiotics. 4 weeks later, I'm great. I'm at the gym, this and that. You do an X-ray, you're still going to see the pneumonia.
Right.
So
okay. So maybe it would have to be an at-risk category, but would the computer technician know enough to differentiate between at-risk and currently underway?
But here's the question. Did the pneumonia happen 2 weeks ago when she had the flu? And she got over the pneumonia. Because if we go on the basis that radiograph is showing us a pneumonia, we treat a pneumonia,
right.
You're going to miss the septic hip.
Right.
Because she had hip pain and fever. So if you take the pneumonia and the influenza only lasts about 7 days in most people, 10 days.
Right.
7 to 10 days. If you take that out of the equation and someone comes in and you say to any medical student, hey, the patient has fever and right hip pain, well, it's a septic joint. They know, but if the patient had the flu 2 weeks ago, presents with a fever now, with right hip pain, muscle ache with the right hip.
They would just separate the muscle ache and focus on the pneumonia.
Oh, it's pneumonia. It's on the X-ray. It's pneumonia. It has to be pneumonia. We got to treat the pneumonia, and you're going to miss the septic hip. So would AI reach a point where they'll say, hey, patient doesn't have pneumonia, patient has a septic hip, the influenza was incidental, has nothing to do with it.
Well, so here's the thing that AI, here's one of the reasons I think AI or machine learning is just machine learning, it's not actually AI right now.
Right.
It's because the human conscience is a risk engine, and that's what we're good at, is figuring out risks. Like, we'll look at things and, okay, what are the possible negatives? And subconsciously, we'll just go and just rattle through risks, and that's something that
algorithms are not up to yet. Maybe no. They will get there one day. I totally think they will, but we ain't there yet.
I don't think so. Until an algorithm has to deal with, where am I going to get my food? Where am I going to get my water? Holy crap, is that a saber-toothed tiger coming up behind me?
Right,
until
right.
It's put in one of those situations, algorithms will never be able to...
Well, it's fuzzy logic. That's the problem. And computers are inherently, you know, they're one or zero. There's two choices. You know, there's everything is just a long series of branches. You just add more branches when you're trying to get more possible outcomes. But, you know, you need to have... The logic is actually different for people, you know, because you have to use fuzzy logic because what you're really doing when you're doing risk analysis is multivariable equations. And they're just probability fields. You know, you can't answer them definitively sometimes. Sometimes you don't know. Okay, this is a little bit bigger than this one. And then there's something else here. Okay, I'm going to go with this one because it's bigger. You know, but AI wouldn't necessarily be able to make that call.
Will it ever?
I think so, but we're not nowhere near it yet.
There are two thinkings in medicine. The predominant thinking is Occam's razor.
Mm-hmm.
The other thinking, which is not as popular, is Hickam's dictum. Which states that...
Do you laugh when I say Hickam's dictum?
Hickam's dictum. Steve, am I pronouncing that right? You get one of those...
No, so, Mel Brooks. We've got a full circle.
Excuse me while I whip this out. Hickam's dictum says the patient can have as many conditions as the patient has.
Mm-hmm.
So it's always a balance between the two. Just because someone has one thing doesn't mean they don't have a second thing. Yeah, you could Occam's razor this till the end, you know, the cows come home, but at the
right.
same time, they could have two different things. And may I give you an example?
Yeah.
I had a patient come in, homosexual male, just came back from traveling in Vietnam and Cambodia.
Okay.
Alrighty. Ate the local street meats. Went to the villages.
Okay.
Presents with left lower quadrant pain,
mm-hmm.
and with rebound tenderness, meaning when you let go, it hurts more.
Oh. Okay.
So, when you say that, it's colitis. It's an infection of the colon.
Okay.
Alrighty, and you need some antibiotics. You need a CAT scan. You need some blood work done.
Right.
But I said, you know, he's been traveling a lot. Something was just little tapping me in the back of my head. I tested him for influenza. He came out positive for influenza B.
Okay.
He was the first patient that season that I had that all the predominantly influenza B loved the left lower quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
And any patient I had with left lower quadrant tenderness, I ran a flu test on them. Mm-hmm. And quite a few of them came back positive for influenza B. So that season, influenza B loved the left lower quadrant, which mimicked colitis.
Right.
Now, how do you apply this? Now, how was AI applied?
So you avoided the temptation to blast them with antibiotics when it wouldn't have done any good.
I'm a little different. My philosophy is I'm only father to one person in this world, my daughter.
Right.
Everyone else is an adult that has to make their own decisions.
Right. So you present them with information and let them choose.
Exactly.
Right.
So it's the choices are CAT scan, antibiotics, blood work, anti-flu treatment. One person wanted to just write it out. Other people wanted all four things. One person wanted just antibiotics. One person wanted just Tamiflu. One person just wanted a CAT scan. You know what? Every choice was appropriate because we had a discussion.
Right.
It looks like colitis. It smells like colitis. It walks like colitis. We have a positive flu B test. And I went so far as to describe to them anchoring errors. Mm-hmm. Meaning we found influenza B, and we are anchored to that diagnosis, and also search satisfaction errors in which we stop looking because we have a positive test.
Right.
These are the words I use for my patients, exactly these words.
Right.
Search satisfaction error, anchoring errors, Hickam's dictum, and Occam's razor. I use those four things with these patients with influenza B with left lower quadrant tenderness. And I said, these are your choices. Could you have influenza B and a bacterial...
Did they understand? What you're talking about? They got it?
Okay. They have to understand before they leave the room.
Right, right, okay.
I will stay there as many hours as I need.
Excellent.
Until they understand.
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, I said, look, you have influenza B documented. There are false positives, but mm-hmm. it's kind of rare with these tests. And you also have signs of bacterial colitis.
Mm-hmm.
I explained each one in turn, and I let them decide. And either way, any choice was appropriate at that point because the patient was making an informed decision.
So interesting. So this is something that's been coming up in science lately.
Yeah.
So I think people have been misusing the terminology of science, in the sense that, to me, science is the ideal science is experimentation, right? Experimentation with a control. Again, we have that problem, that ethical problem with people, where, you know, but how do you solve that? And you have a fairly good methodology for dealing with the ethical implications of using a person as control against themselves, which is give them the choice.
Yeah.
Right. Choice is the answer.
Absolutely.
You know, if you're looking for how to do ethical science without a control, the answer is choice.
Absolutely.
Right. I think there's a larger philosophical construct at work there. I don't know if it has to do with your oath or not, but you know, that's
the patient has to choose.
Right.
And some patients don't like it. I know some patients don't like it because some patients just tell me what to do. And I'm like, I can't do that.
And you know what? And this is one of the things that's wrong with the fire ready aim development model that the computer geeks are using for software development and stuff, like that piece of junk software that makes you click a million times when you shouldn't have to, because they're not giving you a choice. They're denying you the ethics that you're presenting your patients with. Fucked up.
Yeah, it's really fucked
pretty
up.
Pretty fucked up.
It's really fucked up. It's like, but there's a lot of paternalism in medicine.
Right.
It's both ways.
Right.
I'm the doctor. This is what you need. I'm the patient. This is what I need. Mm. I actually had more than one patient actually walk in the room, and here's one example. The patient looks at me and goes, I have a UTI. I don't know why I need you to get antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
I know I have a UTI. I know I need antibiotics. I don't know why I need you. I'm like, you know, ma'am, I really don't know why either.
Well, in the world of antibiotic hand soaps, she has a point.
I don't know either. You should take it up with the American Medical Association and ask them. Maybe they can give you a more clear answer. In the meantime, I'm telling you, by the time she left the room, her shit turned white. When I explained to her why we have to do a urine culture, have to interpret it based on the antibiotics we give her, this and that, I give her the counseling. You know what? She got it. Some patients don't get it. They're like, I just need my antibiotics. I need to get out.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed something about people. I like to give people the choice. Some providers argue with the patient.
Mm-hmm.
You have a cold. You don't need antibiotics. I want my antibiotics. You don't need antibiotics. I want my. And they spent 5 to 10 minutes arguing with the patient.
Mm-hmm.
So I start off with telling the patient, I'm going to send the antibiotics to the pharmacy for you.
Mm-hmm.
With the and you could see when they're talking, they're very tense. And when you see when you say I'm going to send the antibiotics to the pharmacy, their shoulders relax. And once their shoulders relax, I know I have their attention because I tried it the other way with telling them about antibiotics first. And the only thing they said to me at the end is, do I get my antibiotics? But once I tell them, I'll give you your antibiotics with the advice to not use it now, they relax and they actually listen. And I tell them, this is when you use the antibiotics.
Right.
If this is day one for you or day two for you, the antibiotics could help you. It's only about a 2-5% chance it'll help you.
Right.
If you want to roll the dice, you have the antibiotics. But I encourage you to wait for the milestones.
Right. I think they're having the same reaction that a lot of the doctors are having, which is just part of the problem with our culture, with our society as a whole, is that people just have these crushing debts. Financial debts, monetary debts.
Yeah.
And that inspires people like, I can't miss a day of work. You know, I can't afford to have any time off. I can't afford to come back here. You know, unless it's life or death, I can't come back. You know, I need to be able to tell my boss I'm dying to not come back to work. So I need to get it right this time. And then it's good of you to pull them out of that space. But yeah, I mean, I really I wish consumer debt was smaller because I think that I know wishes horses beggars would ride. But that seems to me to be the larger problem. I actually had a question. I wanted to bring something up because we were talking about ethical controls. So vaccination. So this is what's happening with vaccinations and people, you know, I'm not a flu vaccine person. I have had bad experiences. I've gotten sick with flu vaccines. I know how it works. I know that they basically take a gamble on each flu vaccine. Okay, this looks like the prominent one. And sometimes they're right and sometimes they're wrong. So I don't think it's such a big deal. Wrong? That's not correct?
I'm sorry, what?
Yeah. Oh. No, go ahead. Good.
No, go on. I was just thinking.
Okay.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish your thought, please.
No.
I have a lot of things to say about it, but I'd like you to finish your thought.
No, well, so the problem is, so a lot of people, there's a lot of anti-vaxxers out there, and they're not vaccinating their kids with like stuff like MMRs or anything. So, you know, like, I don't really give a crap if people choose for themselves not to take a flu vaccine or not. Because I understand the thinking, right? So if we create, if we stop the flu from existing, then less old people get sick and die, and then everyone's better off and less healthy, or young people, vulnerable people who actually die from it, versus in the middle people where between the very young age and very old age and sick. But I just it just seems to me that the vaccination thing is a preventable situation. So I'm thinking about 1990, when they started putting nutrition facts on food labels. And, you know, I went out and I looked on the net, and I'm trying to find, so the CDC has some ingredient lists for vaccines, and but they're just generic for the types of vaccines, not for the specific, this company's vaccine is this ingredient list. Is there some reason that we can't, first of all, tell me why I'm wrong, and then hope maybe it'll completely invalidate what I'm asking, but if it doesn't, why can't we just put ingredient lists on vaccines? And do we do that already? I just haven't seen them.
Yeah, they do it. Yeah.
Oh yeah, but I mean, is it per vaccine, or is it just per how the vaccine? Is it like the ingredient list that the manufacturer roughly follows, or is it the exact percentages of each ingredient?
Oh no, no, it's there. It's on the package insert.
Do people ever ask for them when they come to the doctor? Should they? It seems like yes, right? I mean,
why not?
You look at the ingredients when you buy food, you put that in your body. Yeah. Why wouldn't you look at the ingredients in your vaccine? It seems to me like a lot of these silly debates would stop if it had a thorough ingredient list and actually people actually looked at it and were able to compare like this manufacturer vaccine versus this one. And a lot of the complaints I'm hearing out there, again, I don't know if they're valid, but are about heavy metals, specifically mercury, aluminum, things
absolutely
like that.
Absolutely, it's atrocious. The thimerosal? Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, so you know what I'm talking about. So,
yeah.
Go ahead. Fire. My statement and question are done. So.
Well, first of all, you know, some patients walk in and they say, I want my vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
Period. Okay, very good. Let's do this. If they are pregnant or their children, I let them know first if it's a multi-dose vial, meaning you get more than one dose from one vial, it has thimerosal and it's a mercury derivative. And I tell them very simply, the FDA says, it's okay for me to give this to you. Would I inject my own child or my own pregnant wife with it? Absolutely not. What would you like me to do?
Nice. Okay.
It's really, and to me, it's equivocal. It's not my body. It's not my child.
Is there a non-thermosol alternative?
Yeah.
Okay. So why the hell are people using the thermosol one?
They really don't anymore. I haven't seen it. It's all the single dose ones usually have no preservatives in.
That's kind of my point. It's like, you know, if there's a less dangerous option that invalidate those arguments, then we could stop this, you know, MMR resurgence.
Yeah.
You know, it just seems silly. Like, why aren't we? What gives, man? Yeah.
So, you know, when it comes to vaccines, first of all, I'm not against anti-vaxxers.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's like they don't want to vaccinate their children, they don't want to vaccinate themselves, that's fine.
I kind of am against them a little bit.
About vaccinations?
I'm sympathetic to individual freedoms, but at the same time, you know, we have a commons, we all have to live, especially living in the biggest city in the country. You know, I'm constantly rubbing elbows with people. If you've got a disease, a preventable disease, and you give it to me, fuck you.
No, but if you have the vaccine, what do you care?
Right, right. But what if my kids haven't gotten it yet? You know, that kind of situation.
Right. Well, but you're a responsible person. You do your best.
Right. The odds are low, but it's not zero.
Right.
They've created a non-zero situation instead of a zero situation for me.
So we start off with the patient who usually pregnant or just gives birth to a child. They ask me, should I vaccinate my child?
Mm-hmm.
That's the first yes or no, 0-1, just like AI.
Yeah.
Should I vaccinate? And I say, do me a favor, go to a reputable website that ends in .edu or .gov, and I want you to learn about each vaccine, about the diseases of the vaccine, and tell me if you're ready.
Which fucking kill people back in the day. Yeah.
If you are ready to mentally, are you mentally prepared to watch your child go through this? I've seen an 8-year-old dying from meningitis.
Nice.
I do not want to see my child go through that.
So they come to you with a binary choice situation.
Yes. Should I vaccinate? That's the first one.
You offer them a third choice. So I'll come back to Hegel later. Okay. So keep going.
Yeah. So first is the patient who asked me, should I vaccinate? And I say, go to the website. If you're prepared to watch your child go through that disease process, no. No vaccinate. Mm-hmm. That's your choice. If me personally, I'm not ready to see any of my children die from a preventable illness. So meningitis, for example, mm-hmm. very important vaccine. Rotavirus, for me, very important vaccine. Mm-hmm. When my daughter was born, I did not give her the hepatitis B vaccine at birth, which is recommended, mm-hmm. because I don't have hepatitis B. My wife doesn't have hepatitis B. Our family members don't have hepatitis B.
Did you delay it?
Yes.
Okay, so we've done that too.
Until we went to see a friend. We planned to see a friend who has hepatitis B.
Ah,
I said,
organized of you. I wouldn't know that.
Time to vaccinate our child against hepatitis B because we're about to go into a household with someone who has hepatitis B.
Right.
We're going to go traveling to blah, blah, blah. Time to do the hepatitis A. Mm-hmm. I don't want her to get hepatitis A. It's not going to kill her, but it's going to put a damper on things. You know, it's.
So we faced an avalanche of shots for our kids. And sometimes it was just one, and sometimes it was three or four to shot. And we always said, no, we'll come back. We'll come back in 3 months.
That's perfectly fine.
Let me settle in. And then that way, because I was afraid of unexpected interactions.
Yeah.
So as a strategy to deal with it. So, I'm not totally fuck you to the anti-vaxxers. I get it. I don't trust government either. I don't trust.
Neither do I.
I don't trust the CDC. I trust them to a point. I trust them to the point that I can see what they're doing. And to the point where I can understand what they're doing. And, one of the problems with our facts in our society is that people can't become experts in everything. And if you don't trust the sources that the majority of people do trust, and you don't have time to become an expert in it, you're up a creek. But it sounds like you're bridging that gap by taking the binary choice and offering a third. So have you ever heard about a Hegelian dialectic before?
No.
So it's this idea, it's this mechanism by which you can force people into a certain direction, choice-wise, and what you do is you offer them a bad choice and a really bad choice. And it's a trick. The secret is the bad choice is the one you want them to pick. So you give them a really bad choice. So if anybody's offering you a binary choice, there's a possibility, I'm not saying it's happening, there's a possibility that someone is using the Hegelian dialectic against you. So you can demand a third choice. Applying it to politics too, right? This is one of the reasons I'm a huge proponent of third parties. I think that would just fix it. If we created a system that would encourage third parties, the problems would be over. So, but anyway, so good job in breaking up the Hegelian dialectic and hopefully discouraging people from running off a cliff with vaccines.
Life's about balance. It's about risk.
What?
Or segways.
I forgot about that.
Pickle Rick.
Segways.
Yeah, so, vaccines, it's a very personal choice. See, my thing is I'm really freedom of choice and educating patients.
Right.
Because if we start mandating vaccines, you just go down that where does it end kind of thing,
Mm-hmm.
It's like, what are you going to do?
You're
going to go tie down people to a table and vaccinate them? Is that what we're going to do? It's like, where do you draw that line?
Yeah, I've read sci-fi where vaccinations were used as a ruse to do other things biologically to people.
And people believe that, by the way.
Yeah.
My patients don't want to. Some patients don't want to get vaccinated because they think it's part of some grand scheme.
Right, right. You're gonna sterilize me, or
sterilization is one of them.
Yeah. That was a sci-fi scenario.
Causing disease.
It was actually a very good book, Gate to Women's Country. I actually read it in ethics in college. And okay, what if men really are super violent, and need to be isolated? So they had devised a scheme where they were dividing the men into the violent ones would go off into a soldier camp, and the peaceful ones would choose to stay in the city and help the women. And I spoiled it. Anyway, there's more to it, but when they were giving them checkups, they weren't giving them checkups.
the men in the the barracks.
Look. Do you blame people? Look how many atrocities were done in United States medicine. The Tzatziki experiment, for example.
Right.
Where they did not tell African Americans that they had syphilis. It's a
that's a fucking disaster. I can't believe that's real.
No, that's real.
I know it's real. I just can't believe it.
It's absolutely real. And it's like, well, what do you expect? What do you expect people, any people for any disease? What do you expect any person to feel as a culture, as a race, as an ethnicity, if someone did something to their people based on some criteria? We all know from the medical books from the time of Hippocrates what neurosyphilis is and what it does. Mm-hmm. Well, okay, not Hippocrates. I'm exaggerating. But since we figured out what syphilis was, we know what it does. There's no reason to run that experiment on people.
Yeah, just you know? Didn't have the sequence of that particular cancer doesn't mean we didn't know what cancer was.
Right, exactly.
They named cancer in ancient Greek times, right?
Yeah, exactly.
It looked like a crab on the outside of the
body. When they cut the cancer open, even now, when you cut the cancer open, it looks like a crab.
Right, right.
So that's why it's called cancer. It's pretty good.
Cool. That was a great answer. I was afraid I was ambushing you a little with that because I was
no ambush away. I like ambushes.
Okay. Cool.
Look, if I don't know, I'm just gonna say I don't know. I don't. So.
Right. Right.
You know how many times I tell patients a day, I don't know.
So how do you deal with? I know there's a lot of push on. All right, one more thing, and then I'm going to come to the big one, which is the thing that you wanted to talk about. I think you know what I mean. I just wanted to ask about drug companies and pushing, you know, handing free samples out to doctors and coming up with partnerships with doctors' offices. What do you think about that? Any input? Have you had any? Have you just said no to them and said get out of here? Have you had good experiences? You know. With the samples that they, you know, because of course the pharmaceutical industry is constantly trying to resolve the same problem because of course the new solution's under patent, the old solution isn't, you know.
I loved them when I was in private practice.
Really?
It was awesome. It was medication for my patients.
Right, free medication.
And I would tell them, I said, listen, you want to come visit me, you got to bring me a lot of samples and coupons for my patients.
Right.
Oh, and you also have to get lunch for the staff once a month.
Nice.
And I tell them, it's like, this is what you have to do if you want to enter.
So it was a good deal, you think, overall?
Overall, as long as they could have an intellectual conversation with me.
They had to go through the gauntlet.
I didn't prescribe their medication. I told them, I said, listen, if you want me to prescribe your medication, besides strong-arming you into, you know, lunch and samples,
right?
You really got to tell me why your medication, and I would put time aside. I would put half an hour aside for a rep and sit there and tell me why your medication is better than the other ones.
So they had to know their craft. They had to know what
their
they
shit.
Were selling.
They had to know their shit.
They had to know their shit, yeah.
One time, I remember, this one rep, she says, oh, and by the way, she was selling some other medication. By the way, I'm going to give you this box of prenatal vitamins. I'm going to give you some prenatal vitamins.
Right.
I said, oh, prenatal vitamins. I picked this up. I look at it. I'm like, flip it over in the back. I'm like, and I look at the back, and I look at her, and I say, are you fucking shitting me? She froze. Like, she became pale. She's like, what? I'm like, you're giving red dye and blue dye to a pregnant woman? I said, are you out of your fucking mind? And she goes to me, this is exactly how I spoke with her.
Right.
It's like you put this thing in front of me with dye. I'm like, she goes, I didn't know it was in there. I'm like, that's even worse. You don't know what's in your own fucking samples you're giving me. I'm like, is this shit in the vitamins that you give pregnant women? If I prescribe this and the pharmacist gives these medications, are you putting this shit in it? Is the same stuff? She goes, yes. I was like, get the fuck out of my office. I said, don't ever come back here with any of your fucking drugs.
Nice.
But come back with your free lunch. That's fine.
All right. Yeah.
No, but
as long as you guys didn't put it together, as long as you bought it someplace local and you didn't put any dye in it.
You know, it's like I'm very against dyes.
Yeah.
I'm against thimerosal, I'm against dyes.
Yep.
And it's so hard, even for when I go shopping for my daughter, for ibuprofen and, you know, acetaminophen, it's like dye. It's like, what the fuck, you know? It's like, I just can't find something that's dye. Now I found something that's dye-free, but, right. You know, it's like all this extra.
It's all the marketing.
You know,
you want to make it the right color.
Things like for me, dyes are on par with thimerosal.
Really?
Yes. We don't know what they do.
Not expecting that.
We don't know all this food coloring.
Yeah.
All this garbage. We really don't know what it does. Do you notice how it just sticks to your skin when you pick out?
Yes.
And it makes your skin red?
Yes. What red or blue
to,
or
right. Whatever. What happens to our mucous membranes? Our inside of our gastrointestinal tract. And once these dyes get absorbed, they might go into the brain.
I don't need any more conspiracy theories, man.
It's not conspiracy. I'm talking just biochemistry.
Yeah, I know. Well, no, I was like, why are they doing it? Nobody ever thought of this before? This
you know why?
Right.
They did
this is only a 2.5-hour conversation. We're already talking about this. How did they not talk about this?
You know what? Because you know what? They actually did studies where they took two groups of patients. They did they drew up the vitamin B12 injection that was not red. And they drew up a vitamin B12 injection that was red.
Right.
And you have to watch, the patient has to watch you draw it up. The patients who saw the red vitamin B12 reported feeling much better than the patients who did not get the red vitamin
B12. Fucking Edward Bernays. That's what that is. It's marketing.
It's marketing. Why does all my medicine have to be red?
Yeah.
Why does it have to be red? Why does it have to be blue?
Right.
Mucinex.
Right.
You know, it's blue. It's like
it's
a blue.
It's literally like snake oil. Because red is danger psychologically, right? And you know, that snake oil was the whole angle, is that poison had some magic in it, right?
Yeah. Yes, the color red has some magic.
Da, da, da. Rabbit of the hat. Yeah. Wow. So, I mean, is this business so that morbid? I mean,
yeah.
You know, I know you've mentioned this a couple times, and I really wanted to talk about it, but I wanted to save it towards the end, in case it got dark. But it's
important. Let's get dark, man.
Let's talk about the suicides.
Let's talk about suicides.
Why did doctors kill themselves? Why did dentists kill themselves? Why do veterinarians kill themselves?
I don't know why dentists. Well, my theory is
a doctor killed himself across the street from my house, in the house across the street.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, why? It just seems like they're so important. Why is this happening?
Because it's not about everyone else. It's about them.
Right.
You know, it's as opposed to, you know, what we usually tell people, it's not about you, it's about everyone else. You know, suicide is a very personal decision.
Mm-hmm.
It is considered, for the most part, depending how you look at it, it's looked upon as a psychotic episode because it goes against preservation of life. It's a loss of the sense to preserve one's life. Some people will look at it as...
Is it just a stigma of mental illness? Is that why it's just tossed aside?
Who knows?
Right.
And I say who knows because every form that I fill out as a physician for hospital privileges, for medical licensure in the state, any employer says, do you have any mental illnesses?
Mm-hmm.
Or medical illnesses that would interfere with your job to become a physician. What am I going to do? I'm going to check yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like, yeah, it's
a friend
dark.
A friend of mine was a cop. He's like, one of the questions on the freaking test was like, do clouds chase you? Yeah, I'm going to write yes on that. Okay.
Exactly. It's like
even if they do, I'm going to write yes on that.
I don't know what that question means, but I know how I have to answer that.
Right. Multiple guess.
So what I spoke with some psychiatrists. I've actually dealt with suicidal physicians.
Mm.
You need physicians to deal with suicidal physicians. You can't have. I mean,
you need a peer.
You need a peer, right? You know what? I appreciate what these hotlines do.
Right.
But really, when someone, if you have a seasoned trauma surgeon,
right,
who wants to kill themselves, they don't want to hear someone who's in college or out of high school tell them why it's okay to live.
Dude, spring break is the best.
Yo, you know, it's like,
you gotta get on the course train, man.
Just because you could train a dog doesn't mean you could step in a cage and train a tiger. You know, they're
right.
Different animals. Same principles, different animals.
Right.
Gotta know how to act around them.
Right, fair enough.
And you know what? It's very hard to look at someone And if you, let's say, like someone in the IT field, if they told me, well, you know, just working with, you know, the blah, blah, blah server just makes me want to kill myself, and it has a depressing sound to the server, whatever. Right. It's like, I can't comment on that. It's like...
users, they're the ones.
Yeah, it's crazy. Out of my field. You know, it's like... Sounds right. Like you should talk to someone, you know, but it's not me, you know,
right.
It's, you know, so a physician.
That's true, yeah, absolutely. No one would know what the problems of an IT guy are.
Right.
If they hadn't had any experience in the computer field at all.
Like people who are alcoholics who go through the 13-step process,
mm-hmm.
You need another alcoholic to guide you through it.
Right.
A recovering alcoholic, because they've been through it. The same thing with physicians. You need a physician who's been through it, who's been through the sleepless nights, who has held the hands of dying patients, who has seen kids die, who, you know, you need someone who's been through it to say, yeah, man, that kind of sucks.
Right.
But let's look at it from this point of view.
So I actually heard a great quote recently. I've forgotten the name of the guy that wrote the book about it, but I think he's right, that addiction is really just a lack of connection. And it seems like suicides, you know, being prone to suicide is very much the same thing. If you don't have that connection with people who are like-minded, who are in the same space, who can, you know, contribute something new to your life, that you just it makes you miserable. You just, your life is pain, and you could self-medicate, right, which becomes addiction.
Yes.
Whether it's endorphin hits on social media or,
yeah.
You know, alcohol or whatever, and you could just end it, you know, because you can't take it anymore. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know if you would. You thought about that? If you think that, I think that's probably true. The addiction is the opposite of connection. But
I could see that. I could see your point of view.
Yeah.
You know, because you're sort of you're involuting into yourself, into your addiction, unless of course you bring other people into it.
Right. I mean, I'm not saying chemical addictions aren't real. I'm just saying, you know, they may take over after a while. Right, so it starts off as a psychological problem, and then it becomes chemical. But and of course, there's the chemistry within the body. I'm talking, you know, that's the differentiation I've made during this show is, you know, external chemical, pouring chemicals into yourself versus the ones you can produce on your own.
But the pouring of the chemicals, I need to go back, and I really need to emphasize, it could come through the eyes as well.
Right.
The chemicals, the frequencies, the blue
yes.
light, the dopamine triggering.
Yes,
doesn't
yes,
matter. Mouth,
yes,
IV, eyes, it's all
right.
The same.
Yeah, you know, I like your view better. It's more holistic.
No.
Mine was a little immature.
No, I liked your point of view as well. But
okay.
I just want to really emphasize the fact that since smartphones came out,
right.
The feelings, like you mentioned, sorry, I didn't mean to point at you, the feelings of...
It's not my fault, man!
The feelings of... there's a graph. The feelings of isolation
mm-hmm.
in the adolescent population has skyrocketed.
Right.
Because no matter how connected, the more connected they get, the more isolated they feel.
Right.
And all, of course, suicidality in adolescence is also going up.
It's even a problem with geeks. It's even a problem with the people who logically... This is one of the reasons I think I constantly tell people logic isn't a panacea. Because it's a problem with the people who logically know how it works.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, you know, a geek knows in a deep way that a lot of other people don't appreciate what an email is. You know? There's just no emotional metadata in there whatsoever. You know? I mean, there's, you know... All right, maybe you can use exclamation points and caps... But, you know, I tell people constantly you have to emote, you know, smiley faces and stuff like that. But even then, you know, it's a
yeah.
very narrow channel. There's very little
very
bandwidth.
Narrow.
You know, all the little cues, the auditory, all the visual cues, you know. And it's sad.
A good percentage of my text messages, actually, I write back to people, say, hey, you said this. Do you mean it like this or like this? I can't tell by your text message.
Right. Yeah, yeah. There's whole memes about that. There's
yeah.
like there's waves of memes about how people wrote something and, you know, a comma takes a kindness to a disaster.
Yeah,
you get fired because of a comma.
Because of a comma, right? Exactly. And it's, you know, you send a message to, you know, 10 different people, and some people could be like, "Wow, what an asshole!" And the other people are like, "Wow, that was so funny!" You know?
Right, right. Partially just the fact that we're just a bunch of meatbags, and that being a doctor reinforces that, you know, when you're literally dealing with fixing people's meat,
you know, the flesh that makes a human being, that we're just all these finite, limited, this limited run creatures that just eventually expire? Is it just hit it home every day? Because is that what it is? Is that part of it? Or
it's how they it's how people view themselves. They want to view.
So it's not about what they're seeing outside themselves. It's how they view themselves. So maybe they feel like they can't help enough, or
how they view themselves is how they view the outside of themselves.
It's the same thing.
Okay. It's really the internal, the what we see in ourselves is how we also perceive the world. If I am smart and confident and beautiful, the world is nice. If I'm stupid and I'm shameful and I can't believe I was fucking up, the world's gonna be bad.
Right.
You know that song, People Are Strange?
Yeah.
You know.
The Doors.
Exactly. You know, faces are ugly when you're strange and.
Yeah. Women are wicked.
Women are wicked when you're not. Exactly. Women are wicked when you're not wanted. But when you're wanted, life is good.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so it's all about how one views themselves. But there's a balance, because you don't want to go off the deep end of, you know, going into that narcissistic kind of,
right.
I'm the best, you know, things in sliced bread. You know, there's a balance between feeling confident, being egotistical, and having a battered ego.
Right.
There's that balance that we have to strive
for. So tell me about the organization that you're starting for suicide prevention, or trying to help other doctors, or.
Yeah, I spoke with a few psychiatrists, and I'm trying to get a system going, in which a physician can present to a psychiatrist. And just not even use their name. Make up a name. Hi, I'm Bob.
Right.
I'm a trauma surgeon. I want to kill myself. I'm bad shape. The psychiatrist will never ask the physician their name.
So it's nothing like this right now?
No. You have to give your name, your insurance card, whatever. So you go in there and say, I don't want to identify myself. Mm-hmm. This is who I am. This is what I do. This is what I feel. In my head, the patient gets a number, kind of like a Swiss bank account. Mm-hmm. You lose your number, you lose your bank account. Sorry.
Right.
You know, and this way, whoever wants to come and review the records, you have a number attached to the record. Who's the patient? I don't know who the patient is.
Right.
But
that's excellent.
It's great, but people don't want that. People want your name and your date of birth and, you know, fill out a form. And all of a sudden there's a record. And nobody wants their name attached to a record where they're feeling, they go to a psychiatrist. Hi, I'm a trauma surgeon. I feel suicidal.
Right.
You know, that's bad. It's bad in the sense that if you tell that to any administrator in the hospital, you tell that to anyone who has a hiring capacity for a physician, they will not hire that physician.
That's terrible.
It's atrocious.
Wow.
So I would personally.
It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yes.
You literally can't have emotions, or you're blackballed.
Right. Or you know, he's laughing at the party. Look how much he drinks. Like a bottle of wine. He's funny. It's funny when he drinks. But it's a type of self-medication for some people.
Right.
So it's like alcohol is perfectly acceptable, nicotine is perfectly acceptable. Now CBD is acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
But people use it, even physicians use it to overcome their pain.
Right.
And that's a vicious circle because it puts
them
in
a more
depressed
state. I really
state.
Like your idea, because one of the reasons I think it will work is because I think that inherently that the problem, if addiction is a lack of connection, then freedom, friendship is the answer to that, right? And friendship, one of the core components of friendship is freedom. Friendship is just giving someone the freedom, giving someone else freedom, but also allowing them to make occasional mistakes, like wanting to hurt yourself, you know, and continuing to be their friend in spite of that. So, based on that, you know, by giving them that connection unconditionally, you're essentially giving them an anonymous friendship, or the qualities of it.
Yeah.
You can tell us about what's going on in your life, and we will not judge you. Yeah. And that should solve it. So, I hope you succeed with that. If there's anything I can do, if you need, you know, geeks, I know geeks.
Yeah, well,
I know Lee knows geeks too. We know geeks. So,
you know, the problem, you know, the thing is,
and we know lawyers. So,
and you put it very right. It's about connection, and it's really about having a safety net and really feeling safe.
Right.
And most of the time, you know, studies were done. It was very interesting. I was listening to an audiobook about this, and they mentioned I forgot who it was. I think it was Tolstoy, Steve. It was Tolstoy, whose brother put him in a corner and told him, "Don't think of a white bear."
What?
Don't think of right now. Don't think of a white bear.
When did he stop beating your wife? Right? You know? Yeah.
You know. So it's kind of like so. The problem is
it's the same problem.
The
right?
same problem. You know.
You just can't stop visualizing the
if
thing
you
you're trying to avoid.
You need to give yourself permission. To feel that, you need to give yourself permission. It's okay to go through it. You need to give yourself permission to say, hey, it's normal to have these feelings. Because if you try to repress it, it's this vicious, don't think about the white bear kind of wind up.
Right, right.
And it becomes somewhat shameful, it becomes an intrusive thought, a recurring thought.
I have really appreciated our time together. Thank you so much for coming on my show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you so much for Dr. Where is Kachoba, right? Is that right? Yeah. Kachoba?
Yes, Kachoba.
Yes. All right, that's I got it right. Thank
Pickle,
you so much.
Pickle Rick!
Please come on again. And
thank you.
Good night, everyone, and we'll see you next week. Thanks again.